Good morning and welcome to the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors October 16th meeting. Please rise and join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation.
And begin with Tommy Gong, item number 6, followed by Julie Tacker, consent item number 22.
Hi, Tommy Gong, Assistant County Clerk Recorder. I'm speaking on behalf of consent item number 6. We're amending the staff report to include the two districts that were inadvertently left off of districts that were requesting consolidation, the two being Allen Hancock Community College and California Valley Community Services District. We're in the process of conducting the election for those two districts. Any questions?
I see none, Mr. Gong, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
Julie Tacker, consent item 22, followed by Trevor Keith.
Good morning, I am Julie Tacker. And this morning I'd like to comment on item 22, which is in regard to a flooding remediation project in Oceano. This is a $2.7 million project, of which $1.3 million of it will be in actual construction. The rest of that is soft costs. And, gentlemen, that is upside down from what we are certainly used to when it comes to constructing a project. We haven't talked about the feasibility of the project. You have had this on your agenda in several different ways. But to talk about the hydrology of the site where this drainage ditch is going to go, the 1,500 feet of pipeline, and then pumping water from what's collected into the Arroyo Grande Creek, and the feasibility of getting a permit to do that, it seems to me that we are heading down a path that may be a dead end. I know when you discussed the pipeline and pump project at Juanita Street in Oceano, that was indeed a dead end when it came to the coastal development permit and a NPDES permit. Overall, what is the benefit of this little project? The island, the area that was flooded in December of 2010, really didn't get the flows from this area. So it's less than a Band-Aid. This project is, I think, constrained by its high groundwater. I haven't seen a geotechnical report on it, but how that water is going to be collected and then expected to perk or be pumped, like I said, into the Rio Grande Creek is a question. I think you're pursuing something that may ultimately be a liability for you. This water will pool in the RV storage area, and if it spills into those RVs, they're quite valuable. And I don't know that we really want to go down this path. And we continue to go down this path. Like I said, you have discussed this a little bit in the past. And I think certainly the amount of money for the very little project that you're getting really needs to be questioned. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Trevor Keith, you're here to speak about a couple of items. So please proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson, Board of Supervisors. Trevor Keith with the Planning and Building Department. The first is item 19, the Energy Awareness Month. And I just wanted to let everybody know that October is Energy Awareness Month. And locally, we have set up a calendar of events that we've been running all month long. And today I wanted to highlight on October 20th, it is the energy event. It will be held at the Vets Hall. It will include morning tracks of getting to net zero energy, energy efficiency, and alternative transportation and alternative fuels, speaker tracks in the morning. At lunchtime, we're having Senator Sam Blakesley come in and discuss energy in California. And then in the afternoon, we're having mobile workshops, including cutting-edge buildings at Cal Poly, demystifying home energy audits and upgrades, and a sustainability winery and vineyard tour. There will also be bicycle safety workshops on-site at the Vets Hall in the afternoon, in addition to all of that. And so I would like to say thanks to all the nonprofit and local agencies that helped make this happen with the Community Action Partnership of SLO County, SLO County Air Pollution Control District, SLO Green Build, USGBC Central Coast Chapter, Association of Building Energy Efficiency Professionals, the Association of Energy Engineers, the Central
Pollution Control District, and C5 will have about 20 different alternative fuel vehicles on display.
Yeah.
Too, if you're interested in that. So thank you,
thank you,
Mr. Keith. Appreciate it. And my final request to speak on consent, Dr. Seehite.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos World Community Workshop. And number one, you're approving $365,854 with the San Luis Obispo Visitor and Conference Bureau to provide various tourism promotion activities. And gentlemen, I'd really like you to think about this. When you think about promoting tourism in this really unique Central Coast community, a positive feeling about the Central Coast is required. An enthusiasm for the Central Coast is required for people to want to come here, stay here, dine, spend money here. And I want you to think about your efforts in that. You know, people that live here tolerate the tourists because they know that it's important to the economy, and it's important to support tourism. But we're talking about seismic testing, and the board is putting somewhat of a position on this testing. And people will not be coming down to Avila the way they did when the whales were there, when they've got a bad feeling about this county and what the county is doing. It is going to affect tourism, and it's going to negate all of your economic investments in tourism if the county doesn't take a firmer stand. imagine what people are going to think about us if we go forward with the seismic testing. People will not go and feel good and spend money and go to these destinations when they've got a bad feeling. They've already got a bad feeling about the impending testing. If they've got a bad feeling, they're not going to go down to the shore thinking they might find a dead fish or a dead porpoise or even a dead whale. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hyde. Mr. Flynn, do you want to speak just briefly about item 22 and what that appropriation is, what's going on down in Napomo? Oceano.
Good morning, Dave Flynn with Public Works Department. Item 22 is approval of a cooperative agreement for contribution of $900,000 from Caltrans towards this project, which enhances the drainage on Highway 1 and the general Oceano area. The project, as presented to your board in the past, is well over $2 million. The estimates that I've seen to it is approximately $1.3 million for construction costs. There is considerable soft costs related to expenses with right-of-way acquisition, coordination with railroad, and the airport. However, the benefits of this project are manifold, and in particular, it's addressing the chronic flooding that occurs on Route 1, even on moderate storms, because of the inadequate drainage along the highway. We see 2 to 3 feet of standing water there. This eliminates emergency access routes. It forces even truck traffic onto residential streets in the Oceano area, and it's something that's been a long problem to be addressed in Oceano. We are certainly appreciative of Caltrans moving forward with their funding contribution, as has San Luis Council of Governments, as, who has essentially programmed over $1 million for this work effort. And in terms of the feasibility of the project, we have sat down and had an extensive meeting with Caltrans. We've looked at the storm drain. It is it's just a gravity storm drain. The slopes and the velocities in the storm drain are all acceptable and have been approved by Caltrans. It is to be collected at a drainage basin adjacent to the Rio Grande Channel, where water will be impounded during high flow events. There is work that will be done with the airport to assure that there is not RVs parked in this area during storm events, and we are working with them on creating an easement which would impound the water outside of where the RV storage is allowed. The flows will be going to Oro Grande Channel. That would be through additional culverts placed in the levees. There is no pumping required for that. In general, it's something that has to be attended to because of the urban development in the area. It creates a lot of runoff, and this is a solution in a constrained area, no less, to impound the water and work with it to prevent it from collecting on Highway 1, as well as
Number 4. And so with that, I'll entertain a motion on consent.
Second.
Okay.
As amended.
All right. Very good. Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes. We have a little deviation in our agenda this morning. Typically, we go to public comment on items not on consent, but this morning we have a number of presentations, and we want to do those first. So we'll have our presentations. I need a motion to approve the presentation calendar.
Second.
Okay. Roll call, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
And Mr. Patterson?
Yes. Thank you. And our first presentation this morning is for the Morro Bay Museum of Natural History, and Supervisor Gibson will read that resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd ask District Superintendent Mr. Nick Franco to rise to receive a resolution honoring the 50th anniversary of the Morro Bay Museum of Natural History, one of the wonderful things that we have in that part of the county. The resolution reads as follows. Whereas Morro Bay State Park became a part of the California State Park System in 1934, and whereas the Morro Bay Museum of Natural History opened in 1962 as the only museum of natural history in the state park system, and whereas the Central Coast State Parks Association has been a partner with California State Parks since 1976 by providing support for the Volunteer in Parks program, and especially in the design and operation of the Museum of Natural History. And whereas the museum utilizes over 100 state park docents and volunteers from the local community to keep the museum running and offers classes and programs recognizing the commitment and value of said docents and volunteers. And whereas the museum is an integral part of the community in its role as educator, now therefore be it resolved and ordered that the Board of Supervisors does hereby honor the Morro Bay Museum of Natural History with a fanfare on the 50th anniversary year for the service the museum has provided to the communities within the county as well as to the many visitors in the area. Nick?
Do you want to get a quick picture while you have a photographer here?
Yeah, you got to get
your hat on.
You got it.
Okay. And I just want to invite you and everyone here on Sunday to come on out to the Natural History Museum at 10 o'clock, and we'll be celebrating right there.
Yeah.
To the mic. With name for the record.
All right. Sorry. I got a little informal there.
Yeah.
So Nick Franco, District Superintendent, California State Parks. And I want to invite you and thank you for this honor and invite you out to the Natural History Museum on Sunday at 10 o'clock.
to enjoy the celebration of this long history and this partnership in the community. As you know, State Parks is going through a whole bunch of issues right now, and partnerships are a big part of what we've been doing for a long, 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 long time. 36 years with the Central Coast State Parks Association. We have representative here from our association. We have docents here who represent the more than or the almost 1,000 docents that are in this district, and 100 of whom work at the museum and keep that place running. And we have our one employee who works at the museum and keeps that place humming along. So thank you very much for this recognition, and we hope to see everyone out there on Sunday.
10 o'clock, you say?
10 o'clock. Sunday.
Okay.
To 4:30.
All right.
Anytime in there.
Yes.
All right. Great.
Good stuff.
Thank you. I've asked Supervisor Meacham to read our next resolution. Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd invite Michelle Skirmont to come up if I could, please. It's my pleasure to read the following resolution. Whereas the County of San Luis Obispo recognizes that no community is immune from natural hazards, whether it be earthquake, tsunami, wildfire, flood, winter storm, drought, heat wave, or dam failure, and recognizes the importance of enhancing its ability to withstand natural hazards as well as the importance of reducing the human suffering, property damage, interruption of public services, and economic losses caused by those hazards. And the County of San Luis Obispo has a responsibility to promote earthquake preparedness internally as well as with the public and plan appropriately for earthquake-related disasters. And whereas the protection of County of San Luis Obispo employees will allow them to facilitate the continuity of government and assist the public following a major earthquake event, and by participating in the Great California Shakeout on October the 18th, 2012, the County of San Luis Obispo has the opportunity to join and support all Californians in strengthening community and regional resiliency. And whereas by supporting the Great California Shakeout, the County of San Luis Obispo...
And I understand you have a presentation for us, Michelle.
Just for a couple of minutes.
Give me some water.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson and Board of Supervisors. Good morning. My name is Michelle Skirmont. I'm an Emergency Services Coordinator with the County Office of Emergency Services, and I'm here this morning to ask, are you ready to shake out? What is shakeout? Shakeout is on October 18th this year. Millions of Californians will participate in the fifth annual Great California Shakeout. It's the world's largest earthquake drill ever. This earthquake drill is a great opportunity for our community to practice how to protect ourselves during an earthquake, to practice drop, cover, and hold on. We respectfully recommend that the board endorse the county's participation in the Great California Shakeout, and we thank you for that. Why do we shake out? We're all in this together. And we know that what we do now before a big earthquake will determine our lives and what they'll be like after the earthquake. As of today, California has over 9.1 million registered participants that will shake out this Thursday, October 18, at 10:18 a.m. Almost 36,000 participants in our community include individuals, families, neighborhood groups, senior care facilities, public and private schools, medical facilities, community and faith-based organizations, nonprofits, businesses, and local government. Last week, the County Office of Emergency Services, along with the American Red Cross, County Public Health, and California Emergency Management Agency, coordinated a pilot train-the-trainer session with our local service providers that service individuals with disabilities, access, or other functional needs, teaching quake-safe actions to those who can't easily drop, cover, and hold on. Three of those care facilities will conduct a press-available drill on Thursday at 10:18 a.m. Through the County Safety Commission, department safety representatives have also been invited to have each county department participate in a drill at 10:18 a.m. this Thursday. We invite our entire county to participate, to be counted, to register at shakeout.org, Participants will receive information on how to be better prepared before the earthquake and what actions to take during and after the shaking. Today, outside the board chambers, we have available a recommended earthquake safety actions document for everyone to take with them. And then on this Thursday, we want you to take action. October 18th at 10:18, you only have seconds. Drop to the ground, take cover under a table or a desk, and hold on to it for at least 30 seconds. And while you're on the ground, look around and imagine what would be happening, what could fall on you, what would be damaged. And finally, practice what you do after the shaking stops. It's only a 5-minute commitment, but it's something that can save your life. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Guillermont. Any questions or comments? Supervisor Meacham.
I would like to comment, if I could. I do this every year, and I want to remind folks again, we're coming up into the holiday season. And if you can't think of something that you want to give to somebody, give them a getaway bag. They're not very costly. You can go to the Red Cross. You can get those. I've got one in my pickup, my Jeep, and my car, and one in the house. And I give them to my grandkids and my kids. It's a great gift, and it's one that hopefully you'll never have to use, but it's always there. So I would encourage you to contact the Red Cross, contact our folks, and they can direct you where you can find these. They're an invaluable asset. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The third presentation this morning, I have the pleasure of reading. It's a resolution proclaiming October 2012 is Healthy Communities Month in San Luis Obispo County. Whereas in 2011, Healthy Eating, Active Living, San Luis Obispo, Heal Slow, and community partners including STRIDE and the Center for Sustainability at Cal Poly, the Central Coast Ag Network, the local chapter of the American Planning Association, the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation, the County Public Health Department, and the County Planning and Building Departments worked with the County Board of Supervisors to name October as Healthy Communities Month and acknowledged all that our community does to make itself a healthy community. Here this morning to receive this resolution is Stephanie Tieford and Janice Fongwood. Ladies. Thank you. Thank you, Stephanie. And ladies, if you would like to comment, please feel free.
Thank you very much, Stephanie Tieford. Good morning. I'm excited to share with you the progress we've made in the last year towards healthy communities in our county. In May 2011, a small group of individuals representing the community, the APA Central Coast Section, County Public Health, County Building and Planning, SLO County Community Foundation, Cal Poly Center for Sustainability, and STRIDE brought Dr. Richard Jackson, a world-renowned researcher on the built environment and its impact on health, to San Luis Obispo. Dr. Jackson's work wasn't unknown to our county, and yet his presentation, Designing Healthy Communities, galvanized our small group into action. We began advocating for healthy communities. The first Healthy Communities Month was proclaimed by this board October 2011, and through the creation of an events calendar promoted and distributed by Heal Slow, that's Healthy Eating, Active Living San Luis Obispo, activities throughout our county that encouraged healthy habits were showcased to individuals and families. We learned from Dr. Jackson's presentation that there is an interwoven relationship between an individual and the environment in which he or she lives, so efforts to promote health have to be broad. In February 2012, our small group formalized as a work group of Heal Slow and began reviewing land development projects, new general plan policies, and community plan updates for the county's unincorporated towns and rural areas. To date, we've provided comment via our Health Commission on 11 projects. Providing comment from a health perspective is aligned with a growing national trend to introduce health in all policies. Our interdisciplinary work group is mentioned in the July 2012 California Adaptation Planning Guide as an example of how groups must work together to address the health of a community. This year for Healthy Communities Month, in addition to Healthy Events Calendar, which can be found at the HealSLO website, HealSLO will also hold a summit titled Building Healthy Communities. Janice from the SLO County Community Foundation is here to tell you about it.
Good morning. I'm Janice Fong Wolf, Director of Grants Programs with the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation. As a member of the Steering Committee for HealSLO, I want to thank the board for its support for each of you in participating and being co-sponsors of this year's summit. In 2010, we held our first countywide summit, and at that time, we had nearly 250 participants from a cross-section of the community begin the dialogue on how our county could turn the tide on childhood obesity. As you've heard and will hear, since then, some exciting collaborative work has occurred. This year, we have over 280 registered attendees, representatives of the medical community, planning, parks and recreation, schools, social services, agriculture, nutritionists, and therapists will join together to hear from such nationally recognized speakers as Dr. Ann Haddix of the Centers for Disease Control, Michael Dimmick from the Roots of Change, who will address the role of the local food system in the obesity epidemic, Dr. Richard Jackson on the connection to the built environment, and Paul Zykowski with the Local Government Commission. This conference will also highlight local panelists who will discuss how our community has taken a leadership role in addressing the change in the systems level for a healthier community. I know Supervisor Patterson will be joining us for a portion of the day, and I hope that each one of you will be able to come by and check us out on Friday, October 19th at the Mountain Brook Church. And for more information, the public can go to our website at www.healslow.org and also either contact Kathleen Carley with the Public Health Department at 781-4929. And thank you again for recognizing us as Healthy Communities Month.
Thank you very much. I'm thrilled that we've finally made the connection of health and how our communities are planned and designed and function, and incorporating the food system that we're so blessed to have. And this actually leads into our next presentation, and I'm going to call up Joel Derringer to give a presentation on an activity that, again, has combined a number of partners from throughout the county representing different sectors of our community to develop a roadmap for overcoming hunger and obesity in San Luis Obispo County. And it's called The Paradox of Plenty. So, Mr. Derringer, you're getting your PowerPoint up and ready.
And I'll talk a little bit more about who's been on it and what the mission of the Food System Coalition is in our county. We also were able, with the grant funds, to commission three studies to look at not only the extent of hunger, but the reasons for hunger, and also the nutritional deficits among food-insecure populations. And those, two of them were done by the STRIDE Center at Cal Poly and one by the Central Coast Ag Network. And the most important thing was producing our hunger-free community plan, which I'll be presenting to you today. This actually is the wrong slideshow. This is the one left on from the Planning Commission meeting last week. So,
The one with all the complicated details in it?
That's right, because we were able to present to the Planning Commission. Let me see what I can... Okay. They're mostly
Do you have the other one on there?
No, it's not on there. I have it on here, but I'll be able to go through it here. Okay. I'm sorry. You know, she said, oh, it's on here, and I said, okay, great. So we were able to commission the local research that looked at who is hungry, or what the term is used often, food insecure in the county. What are the primary barriers to food access? We looked at the local food production system. We also looked at the nutritional value of the food that was being consumed by residents. And then what resources or services currently exist in the county to address food security and hunger. So I'll be very brief. So some of the key takeaways, now these were 100-page reports, all of which are available on the food bank's website at slowfoodbank.org. The first one was that there's actually very low participation in our county in existing food assistance programs. Now, that's programs like what we used to know as food stamps, which is now CalFresh. Our county, according to statewide data, has one of the lowest participation rates. And these are programs that provide assistance not only to the person who gets the benefit, but also to the local retailers who are able to then sell more food to these folks. In our county, we learned from the agricultural commissioner that there's enough fruit and vegetables produced in our county to feed every single person in the county 7.5 pounds a day. Now, most of that is, as we know, for export out of the county. That's the business that many of our growers are in. But there's clearly not a quantity issue in the county. It's much more of a distribution issue. Children are disproportionately affected by hunger in the county, as well as Latino populations and, of course, low-income populations. And then a very high percent, over 50% of people in the survey that Cal Poly conducted, said that on a monthly basis, they have to choose between food and housing costs, between food and medical costs, between food and utilities. So clearly there's a trade-off in there, and why people are going hungry is not always about food. In fact, there's a lot of other issues going along with that. Also, healthier food in the county is often more difficult to find than unhealthy foods. For instance, whole milk, which is less healthy actually, is less expensive than low-fat milk. White bread is much less expensive than whole wheat bread. And this was found through a food store survey conducted by Cal Poly. And then also in our county, about 50% of adults are overweight or obese. That's part of why we're taking a whole view of this and working on the healthy communities. Let me talk a little bit about what the process we went through for developing the plan that I'm going to present to you. It was developed by the Food System Coalition, which is a stakeholder group of folks from agriculture, folks from nutrition and public health, the education sector, social services, food distribution, and the Ag Commissioner, and the Planning Department has also been part of it. So we've had a lot of support from county departments, as well as many members in the community. And the mission of the Food System Coalition is to promote a sustainable food system that is equitable, profitable, resilient, and health-promoting in San Luis Obispo. And the coalition itself will continue meeting long after this plan hopefully is implemented, certainly past the point of it being promulgated. Now, part of the process in developing the plan was also then, once it was adopted by the coalition, was to go around to a broad range of stakeholder groups and obtain endorsements from them. So what we bring to you has been endorsed by the County Health Commission, by the County Planning Commission, by the Farm Bureau, the Ag Liaison Advisory Board, CAPSLO, HEALSLO, and when we're talking about here food for low-income people, that comes from food distribution centers, many of which are coordinated by the food bank. The other one is food assistance programs, things like CalFresh, that allow one to purchase food using subsidies. There's also a number of feeding programs, as you know, school lunch, school breakfast. We're underutilized in summer feeding or after school feeding. There's also the senior nutrition programs that provide direct meals to the elderly. The second goal is not looking at the quantity of food, but the quality. So the goal here is to have improved nutrition of county residents who experience food insecurity. So we look at that by increasing the availability of nutritious food in the county. In local communities, because you can go to areas, diverse areas in the county, go to Shandon, go to San Miguel, and it's difficult to find fresh produce. It may grow around you, but it isn't necessarily available in the stores. We're also trying to prioritize for institutions to promote healthy and also local food, and that ties into something that the county did a few weeks ago in adopting a buy local policy for the county. We're also going to try and work with health providers, because they're the ones that actually, you know, when you think of malnutrition as a health issue, the lack of food as a health issue, this is something the medical community needs to get more engaged in. And one is to help them know where the resources are for people who are hungry or have malnutrition. There's also a lot recommendations on increasing the education and awareness on how to maintain a healthy diet. The Public Health Department and the Department of Social Services and Co-op Extension have been doing education with low-income recipients on how to choose wisely and economically, and then how to prepare nutritious foods. The third goal is looking at our food system. And we're blessed in this county, as I said, to have a very vibrant food system. And we want to keep a sustainable local food system that's able to meet the needs of county residents. One thing, even though we produce a lot of food, we don't necessarily have a lot of food processing opportunities here. So one example would be if school districts want to purchase local produce, it really needs to be pre-cut and washed the way that schools don't have kitchens anymore. They sort of open big bags of salad and put it in a big bowl, if they have salads. So what we're also looking at here is opportunities for local food processing and distribution and marketing and sales. I think many also gleaning. We have an excess of produce here, and the growers have been very, very generous in donating food to the food bank. Many tens of thousands of tons a year get donated. But there's excess, as all the growers will tell you. But what we need is, through combined efforts, is an easy way for that to happen. So Glean Slow, which is an organization working with the food bank, has been trying to coordinate not only with the commercial growers, but also backyard growers who have an excess of produce. Agriculture, as we know, is very large industry in our county, but has not really been promoted as an economic development tool, and that's something we're supporting. And then we also want to make sure that we protect and enhance our food production resources in the county, whether it's preservation of land, air, water, or keeping away pests that would make it non-productive. The fourth out of the five goals is to really address the root causes of hunger. As I alluded to earlier, it's not about lack of food in the county. It's lack of distribution, but it's also lack of resources for many other reasons to get at some of the root causes. So one thing we can do to solve this is to make ending hunger a community priority in our county. We can also support existing programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit, which makes more funds available to local families so you're not stuck choosing between rent and food. We also want to increase the utilization of federally funded programs. We're not talking about using local resources. We're talking about drawing down the resources that are available to everyone in the country, but somewhat underutilized in our county. And then lastly, the last goal is to have a vibrant county food system coalition that I described to you earlier, and an effective community plan, which means that it's not set in stone at this point. It's going to be an iterative process. There's a work group of the Food System Coalition overseeing the community plan, the Hunger-Free Community Plan, and we'll be revising it as needed. And let's see. So, and that can go rushing through the planning. For those of you at the Planning Commission, you may have seen those. I want to thank you for all your support, doing a lot more outreach in trying to promote it. They've also made one of their goals and are implementing it now about allowing for CalFresh benefits through the electronic benefits transfer card to be used at farmers markets. And this is a national effort, and the department, the County Department of Social Services, has been very good in trying to get that out there.
Right. So, and I understand that at least in the North County Farmers Market, they're attempting to utilize that, and perhaps others.
That's
sort of
the first
a complicated
pilot
process, but it's underway. And then, so what, again, Joel, if you would, we have this paradox of plenty, this game plan now that's drafted. What are the implementation strategies?
Well, for each,
forward?
for each of these strategies, we actually have a timeline. They're not all to be implemented at the first time. We're not changing the high cost of housing in our county immediately. So that's a long term. We have short, medium, and long term. We also have lead agencies identified for almost all of the strategies. So these are groups like CAPSLO or the Public Health Department who said, you know, that's something we're interested in. The Farm Bureau, when I met with Jackie Crabb, said, you know, we'll take these two things. And so we're really trying to make this a community plan that people have ownership of, and that's why we went and presented it. And then, so those are all being implemented now, and there's going to be the oversight from the work group at the Food System Coalition.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. Comments from my colleague, Supervisor Getson, and I do have a couple of requests to speak from the public. So we'll start with my colleagues on the board. Supervisor Getson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Dieringer, for bringing in all the folks. I see the row about four rows back there of all the different folks who've worked on this, which is really impressive. It, you know, to me, that there is hunger in a county, in a state, and a nation that is this affluent is just stunning. And I was reading somewhere of a nationwide study on food insecurity, and I can't remember the percentage, but there are tens of millions of people in this country who are food insecure. I'm trying to add some urgency to the effort here. Do you happen to know, or does one of your committee there happen to know, what are the numbers on food insecurity here?
Okay.
In the county?
So in our county, and this is one of the slides that I thought I had, 15% of people in the county, over 40,000 county residents, during the course of the year may go hungry or not know where their next meal comes from. Now, in 2009, some harder data among adults, there were 11,000 adults in our county who were what are called food insecure, and 3,000 had very low food security. So what we mean is that they did not have access at all times to enough nutritious food for an active, healthy life. So those are some of your basic numbers. Right. You know, food banks reaches about 44,000 people a year. It's seen a 40% increase in demand over the past few years. So it's not, it's a growing issue. It's not actually a diminishing issue in the county.
That's the sad thing. I look forward to this plan moving forward. I think there are a lot of connections that are identified there that need to be strengthened. For instance, that between the economic well-being of agriculture in this county and the food security and the nutritional quality of our county food supply. And I look forward to working on those with those of the very diverse group that you work with. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Dieringer. Let me open it to the public, and then if you'll stand by, there may be some questions that come up. I'll open it to the public. I do have some requests to speak on this item, beginning with Mike Brown, followed by Jeff, and I'm not sure I'll get this name right, but it looks like Grandinetti.
Yeah. Okay. Mike Brown, representing CoLab. Many of our members are involved very directly in the production, processing, distribution of food here. We thought that the report was presented some good data that was significant. The one that the from 2002 to 2009, about a third of the students in the school systems were on some sort of free food or subsidized food, and now that number's jumped to 43%. In 2011, 44,000 people were served by the food bank. It says it's a 90% increase from 2006. 35,000 residents are available for are eligible for references. So one of the statements, this is on page 21 of the document, it says the current industrial food system is characterized by high energy and waste. Consumers are more distanced from their food, and farmers throughout the nation are often among the food insecure population. It is the industrial system, the ability to transport food, fertilizer, fuel, that grows the crops in bulk and distribute it without the vagaries of weather or pests or whatever, that has been the greatest boon to civilization, population, and the standard of living in the world, and especially in this country in the entire history of civilization. And we think you ought to look at this and some of the other statements here and not take that as a blanket.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Jeff, followed by Eric Greeney.
Good morning, board, staff. Thank you for being here. My name is Jeff Grandinetti, and I'm a resident of Atascadero, have been my whole life. And I'm here just to advocate for people who need more food in the county. I do a lot of volunteer work with Atascadero Loaves and Fishes and the El Camino Homeless Organization in Atascadero, both of which are faith-based organizations that help the needy in the town. And they do so with very little funding, so they're very very great resources for the community. But I wanted to come here just as a citizen to say that they need your support now more than ever. With the economy being what it is, they definitely need more donations. They need people, they need feet on the ground. They need eyes and hands and hearts out there that can go do the gleaning, for example, to pick up food from the food bank or other organizations to work together with. They need people with trucks. If anyone has an extra truck or anyone has extra time, they're definitely looking for more help with that. And I wanted to speak a little bit to the underutilization of the federal assistance programs for food. Being a lifelong resident of this county in Atascadero, I used to work at a grocery store there, and the first of the month, my supervisor referred to as, quote, white trash day, and I had to ask, well, why is that? And she said, well, that's the day they get their food stamps renewed. So there's definitely a public image problem where people are embarrassed to ask for food assistance because it's projected as a sign of weakness, that, to take a word from the presidential debates, that they're slackers if they need food assistance, when in fact that's just a very ridiculous political lie. That is a misrepresentation of the actual situation, which is that many of the people who are food insecure are your neighbors and people who are active in the community. Atascadero Loaves and Fishes, for example, 89% of the people that we assist with food are families of veterans or veterans themselves. And I feel that while it's certainly outside of your control and your purview how other people respond in political forums, that maybe I could request that you guys set an example not to take that tone, because that's one of the main reasons why people are choosing to go hungry rather than face the shame of asking for assistance. And to me, that's just kind of insulting to say that people who were willing to give their lives for their country are slacking off and that they don't really need that assistance if they just tried harder. Another underserved group would be the teachers out at Community Cuesta. More than half of them are all part-time. Many of the teachers, people with PhDs, are on some sort of food assistance, whether it's CalFresh or WIC or what have you. And I see I only have 5 seconds left. I just wanted to speak to Goal 2, Strategy A1, which says in part, to provide greater opportunities for food insecure populations to shop at farmers market by enabling the use of CalFresh and EBT. And while that has not been implemented yet in this county, I just wanted to say that I know for a fact it's been implemented in dozens of counties, especially up north, San Francisco, Alameda, Crescent City, Petaluma. A lot of counties are doing that. It's very possible. You just have a token program where people use their EBT card, scan it at the manager for the farmer's market, whoever's in charge of it, and then they use those tokens to buy food. It's really not that complicated. And if anybody would like any help with that, I would just like to volunteer my services for that. And thank you for your time.
Very good. Jeff, thank you very much. And I know the farmer's markets are working on implementing that program. So thank you. Eric Greening, followed by Ron Alsop.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and the attitudes the previous speaker referred to are unfortunately rampant. Have we learned nothing since Dickens tried to awaken our social conscience 150 years ago? Oliver still wants more, and he deserves more. People have a right to be fed. Children have a right to be fed, all of us. But in any event, some of this, what could possibly be more immoral than to subsidize the single occupant vehicle habit by making people hungry? That is what this nation's ethanol mandate does. It doesn't even help with global warming. The energy returned on energy invested is less than one in terms of industrial scale corn-based ethanol production. Even though we are not particularly in that game, we need to be heard from. The whole country needs to be heard from. 40% of this drought-stricken nation's corn crop is going into gas tanks while people are hungry. Can we live with this, or are we going to put something on our legislative platform? And then, of course, locally, we need to do everything. This has a nexus with our climate action and our water policies. To the extent that climate changes, agriculture suffers and hungry people suffer. So that is a reason we need to be very, very serious about our climate action plan. In terms of protecting water for agriculture, we need to be very, very serious about the emerging threat of hydraulic fracturing, which is already ruining water supplies in other parts of the country, and people are finding themselves often helpless to deal with it. So there's a lot to be awake with in our legislative and local legal policies that are your responsibility. Please take it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. My final request to speak on this item, Ron Alsop.
Good morning, Ron Alsop, County Office of Emergency Services. I just wanted to briefly take the opportunity to mention that the Food Bank Coalition is somewhat ties into their Goal 5 related to overall coalition. As a member of the San Luis Obispo County Voluntary Organizations Assisting in Disasters. And the Food Bank actually has a disaster plan that they would assist countywide with food distribution and other resource needs. So they're actually a formal part of that organization under Mr. Hansen's leadership. And I just wanted to acknowledge that. And if we do have a large disaster, their current existing coalition and distribution system will be very helpful. And we appreciate their service and participation.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Alsop. And that gives me a good lead-in. I want to thank the folks who over the last year or so have been working on this project for us. We have the Hunger Free Committee, the Grant Steering Committee. Mr. Derringer mentioned the USDA grant that actually funded this process, and there is a steering committee. The membership includes Becca Carcel, Carl Hansen, Janice Fong Wolf, Kathleen Carley, Kim Pasciuto, Jenna Smith, and Stephanie Tieford. And so I want to thank them, but also to give you an idea of how broad an effort this is and the number of organizations and agencies that are participating in this, I want to read that long list too, just so people have an idea of who's involved in this project. The Cal Poly Center for Sustainability, the Community Action Partnership of San Luis Obispo County, the Central Coast Ag Network, the First Five Coalition of San Luis Obispo, EcoSlow, HealSlow, the Sierra Club, the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation, San Luis Obispo County Farm Bureau, San Luis Obispo County Department of Social Services, the County Office of Education, the County Public Health Department, Slow Veg, Stride, which is an organization at Cal Poly as well, and the Cooperative Extension Service. So you can see that the players here are quite diverse, quite committed, and those of you that have been involved in this effort, thank you for that. Thank you for the presentation this morning. Any further questions from my colleagues? No. So thank you. We will move on then to the next item on our agenda this morning, and that is general public comment on items not on the agenda. And we will begin with our county clerk recorder, Julie Rodewald, followed by Mike Brown of COLAB.
Good morning, Board. I'm Julie Rodewald, County Clerk Recorder. It's now E-21 for those of us keeping track. Just a reminder to everyone that next Monday, October 22nd, is the last day to register to vote. So get your voter registration cards in. I also want to give a brief report on the California Online Voter Registration Project, which was launched 3 weeks ago, tomorrow, statewide. They've received over 400,000 voter registrations using the online system, and in San Luis Obispo, we've received almost 4,300 registration cards through the online system. It's been a, we're working through some bugs to the voters. It's absolutely seamless. It gets them registered. Almost the number of people that are requesting PERM status is increasing greatly. And I also want to remind people that they can find out a lot of information on our website, which is slovote.com. They can look up the status of their vote-by-mail ballot. They can look up their polling place, and they can also register online.
Can they get information on the various ballot measures?
Yes, all of our sample ballot, the sample ballot booklets, the voter information guides are tied to a ballot type. So by entering their address, they can access the ballot itself as well as the voter information guide. And we have a link to the statewide voter guide, which with 11 propositions is quite thick this year.
Very good. And again, the last date to register to vote is
Monday, October 22nd. It has to either be received or postmarked by next Monday.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mike Brown, CoLab, followed by Eric Greeney.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. On November 13th, you're scheduled to take up the proposed changes to the agricultural cluster subdivision ordinance. And the map I passed out here is from a economic supplement to the EIR that was done a few years ago. And the orange area depicts, the orange area plus the purple area depicts the areas that under the current ordinance are eligible to try to apply for a ag cluster subdivision if they have more than 40 acres, I think it is. And the proposal coming to you from the Planning Commission, the base proposal, is to eliminate the possibility for being able to apply for it in the orange area, which constitutes about 990,000 acres. And this has some direct economic consequences for estate planning, financing, recapitalization, and so forth over time. And so we think that since this has just been advertised or will be advertised in the paper, really since people are directly affected, they need to get a letter or something from the county that explains exactly what this is so they could make an informed decision about it. And we don't know how many people, but the EIR seems to suggest that by collapsing it to the purple area and using a stricter calculation of the distance as part of that, there'd be a very substantial curtailment of the program over time, although it hadn't been that big in the past. One thing you might consider is, what's the problem you're trying to solve with this, and do you need to do anything at this time? But in the meantime, and you have a month, you ought to notify these people what's going on directly. It's got some serious requirements in there.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Brown. Eric Greening, followed by, looks like, Sharon. And I can't read the name, Sharon. Hopefully there's only one of you out there. So you're on deck.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Eric Greening, and I'd like to remind two of you that you'll be in a LAFCO meeting during the shakeout, and I hope LAFCO participates. Anyway, I'm very thankful that you have scheduled hearing time on the 30th. To revisit the county's position relative to seismic testing. To help us prepare for that, some questions. Obviously, we've mostly worked with Mr. Gibson, who is not staff in terms of the information we work with till now. Will there be a staff report prepared by this for this time, and if so, by whom? Will this packet be open to submissions, and if so, if there's information about alternative testing methods or something else that the community wishes to submit, should they submit it to whom and by when to be included in this packet? The county is not issuing a permit, so PG&E is not an applicant before the county, but there was discussion about having them present here as a kind of a quasi-applicant. If so, would informed opponents or informed proponents of alternative methods be given equal time on an official basis? If so, which opponents, since there are multiple groups currently very much opposed to what PG&E is proposing? I would suggest that if we're going to set it up that way, we not overlook the Shumash, which of all groups being opposed, and of course there are multiple Shumash groups, have been organized the longest as groups, like 10,000 years or so. In any event, we need some clarity about what seismic guy, when push came to shove, said that schedule to him is not as important as getting it right. And they were even talking about maybe the possibility of fudging the March 2015 deadline for the information to be not only gathered but analyzed, if we could get better data by taking the time and not being stampeded into doing it PG&E's way. So we need some context when you're making that decision. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Greening, and we will address that at the end of public comment. We'll address your question. Sharon, you're up, and if you'll help us with your last name, please. And Sharon will be followed by Ted Levine.
Thank you. My name is Sharon Ripner, and I live in the Squire Canyon area of the county. I am here to introduce an issue which I think is one of the most urgent for our political life, from the local to the national level. This issue is our current inability to regulate how much money is spent in our elections and by whom. I was a long-term advocate for campaign finance reform, and in 2002, I was encouraged when the bipartisan McCain-Feingold bill was passed. This bill made some real gains in demanding both transparency and advertising sponsorship and in restricting campaign spending by organizations and groups. However, in 2010, the Supreme Court ruled in a case entitled Citizens United versus the FEC. And in this case, the court upheld the First Amendment right of free speech was prohibited from restricting independent political expenditures by corporations and unions. The result of this ruling was that the McCain-Feingold bill was gutted, that money was equated with speech, and that it therefore could not be limited. Unfortunately, we have seen the results of this ruling. Massive amounts of money are being spent in our current election cycle. Nonprofit, in quote, organizations have been established for the sole purpose of funneling money from wealthy donors to fund specific issue or candidate campaigns. Because nonprofits do not have to disclose their contributors, the voting public has no way to identify those sponsoring the campaign advertising. So now we have not only hard money and soft money, which McCain-Feingold sought to regulate, we also have dark money. That is money that comes from unknown sources with unknown agendas and is being used nonstop to campaign for or against specific candidates and issues. From my personal observations, the darker the money, the more negative and/or misleading the advertising is. The majority of Americans, regardless of party affiliation, are not in favor of this turn of events. So what do we do to fix this mess? I volunteer with a national nonpartisan, truly nonprofit, grassroots effort called Move to Amend. Our goal is to have every city, county, state in the country sponsor a resolution in support of amending our Constitution. we can do that. I had to wait till I was 21 to vote. Now people can vote at the age of 18. We want to amend the Constitution to define money as property, not speech, and therefore make it subject to regulation in our electoral process. I ask this board to schedule a discussion with respect to issuing a resolution in support of this amendment effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Whipner. Ted Levine, followed by Amir Burstein.
That's Levine.
Levine.
Hi, I'm Ted Levine. I moved to San Luis Obispo County about 5 years ago. I'm out in the boonies. I love it here. It's a great place, and I really appreciate this forum here. Gives a sense of community, and you'd be surprised how many people actually listen to it on the radio. When I was a kid back in Ohio in the 60s during the Vietnam War, I was stunned and amazed to find out that my older brothers were old enough to be drafted into the Army and go and fight and die in a war, but they weren't old enough to vote. It was wrong, and we fixed that. About the same time, I found out that women not unlike my mother, were not allowed to vote until relatively recently. Now, this blew my mind because my mom was a hell of a lot smarter than my dad was. And so we fixed that. Made sense. It was wrong, so we corrected it with an amendment to the Constitution. Now, the Supreme Court made a big mistake in 2010 when it ruled in favor of Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. They've effectively reversed much of the progress accessed by everybody, and it's become reality for some people. So many people believe everything that they see and hear on there, whether it's true or not. They believe it as long as the production values are good. Those debates tonight, believe me when I tell you, people are going to be more interested in body language and the hair color, who's covered more gray, than they are interested in the candidates' attitudes and their positions on the Afghanistan war. That's a fact. Now, the guy who raises the most money is going to get the most votes. The judge whose character is most effectively impugned on TV doesn't get reappointed. The common sense proposition that gets slammed the hardest by big money doesn't get passed.
Mr. Levine, your time is up.
I'm sorry.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Amir Burstein, followed by William Ostrander.
Thank you for having me. My name is Amir Burstein, and I belong to the Move to Amend group. We've been communicating with the public by putting a table in various occasions in the mission and other venues and eliciting responses from the public for the issues that you just heard about. And I just want to share with you some of the responses that I've been hearing from people. Basically, people are saying things like they feel beaten down, they feel frustrated, they feel powerless and hopeless and frustrated and angry and fed up with the democracy system that they thought that they grew accustomed to. And people say, what can we do? What can we do in facing this astronomical amount of money being poured into the electoral system? So people say, this is not my country. I have one vote, but what does it do if people like Mitch McConnell, the senator from Kentucky, who claims that the most important thing to do is to defeat Obama and to pour no matter amount of money to buy that. So it's just very frustrating and very disappointing that this is what the electoral system came to, and we hope that you will pay very serious attention to this issue and give it consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Burstein. William Ostrander, followed by Ben DeFada.
Good morning, Chairman Patterson and Board of Supervisors and staff. I, too, am part of Move to Amend, and I'm here to try to make the point of how this is local. What we're asking you to do is to pass a resolution. Now, what is a resolution going to do for us? Well, basically, as our community leaders, we're asking you to step up and ask our federally elected officials to craft a document, an amendment to the Constitution, that says that we believe we've gone off the rails here a little bit in how our democracy is being run. We have empirical evidence that shows that 90% of all elections are won by the party who spends the most money. Our democracy has a cost-benefit analysis. And in most cases, that's good. But when you have 196 Americans able to provide about 80% of all the dark money that goes on in elections today, you have less than 1/1000th of a percentage of the population able to influence the outcome of our elections. And why is this relevant on a local level? I'd like to read for you, for example, that in Oklahoma City, a super PAC committee for Oklahoma City Momentum spent $400,000 on four candidates, and three of them were elected. I imagine that most of you have spent somewhere around $200,000 to be elected. In mayoral races and in council races across the county, that number is maybe $25,000 to $30,000. I myself have been a developer. On a project that I wanted to get through, $25,000 is not much money to push to a candidate who may be in opposition to my project or who may be for my project. This has local resonance. We need to make sure that we are acting locally but thinking federally. And the way to do that is to amend the Constitution, because right now the five of you may see the value in regulating how much money is spent in elections or the city councils throughout the county. But at the end of the day, it's a moot point, because the Supreme Court has already decided that you don't have the right to legislate how money is being spent in our local elections. That has implications across the county. I've only read you one, or across the country. I've only read you one from Oklahoma City. There are others in Durham, North Carolina. This has an impact even on the physical level for the local communities. There is a report that has shown that giving this opportunity for large corporations and people who have tremendous wealth to influence elections results in tax loopholes and offshore tax havens. Currently, this abuse results in each small business owner in America being shortchanged by an average.
It's from Sacramento and D.C. But worst of all, the taxes you five have mandated on us for the Los Osos Sewer Project is criminal. With taxes due again, the citizens have now received a big hit again with a whopping $250, $350 a month sewer bill increase for the next 30 years, a sewer cost that you five could have cut in half if you had cared for the citizens instead of your contributors. Better get more food at the food bank ready for the worst part that will be coming up. But you chose not to do that. Instead, you let one man and his comrade who has never built a wastewater project before run you ragged with a lot of spin. Those two decided on a flawed, overpriced, unaffordable energy hog with its 50 miles of deep pipes with four seismic earthquake faults under or nearby the village of Los Osos that sits on a sand dune with 5,000 years of buried Indian artifacts, flawed recharging sites, and many other problems with their stinking gravity system that Julius Caesar used 2,000 years ago. Yes, that's the same man and the same board that wants to kill millions of sea life with his $64 million idea of using powerful blasts to see if this outdated atomic bomb electrical generating plant can withstand a Japanese-sized earthquake, and even after other countries are now phasing them out. Your board even continued to give him the millions needed to build a treatment plant on 643 acres several miles out of our basin, and even to the point of allowing good treated water to be sprayed in the air, never to be seen again down Windy Torrey Road. What a waste of millions of dollars on our homes that no one seems to be accountable for. If this was a private company, you would be told to turn in your parking pass, clean out your desk, take the pictures of your boat, your plane, your wife, and your girlfriend with you, and get out. You never even ask them, hey, why are you doing this to this little town? But better still, you four never even bother to ask, hey, let's take a look at the newer technologies that are millions of dollars cheaper. Show us why the alternatives were not good enough to be included in the bidding. Were you all in a trance, hypnotized, or sweet-talked into spending money we don't have? Yes, definitely. It appears you are all in this together. The gentrification of the people of Los Angeles is happening right before our eyes. What else could you call it?
Thank you, Mr. DeFatta.
Thank you, sir.
Gwen Taylor, followed by Julie Tacker.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I'm a resident of Los Osos. The Public Works, the team, and Supervisor Gibson's lack of an update of the sewer project has and is causing many questions. In March of 2012, the public was told by Supervisor Gibson that work on the sewer project would begin the end of July. That was in March. In June, the informational meeting held by the county at the middle school gave the public information as to what to expect. The project did not begin in July 2012 as promoted. We were told that on-site offices in the community would be available for information and questions such as the cost of permits to hook up to the sewer line, the additional costs of removing trees if they are 8 inches in diameter, or the permit to replace a toilet if they do not comply with retrofit of the implementation plan as of October 2012. How do we know what the final decision regarding septic tank decommissioning has been? What are all the additional costs going to add up to? The restoration of the Tri-W site was a condition of the Coastal Commission permit for the sewer project. This restoration was questionable when the first rain has caused damage to the site. Believe me, it's damage. The mulch has been dislodged and has not controlled the erosion problem that it was supposed to control. This is on the site of one of the areas to be used for the dewatering of the trenches and recharge of the basin. Yet the water on this site of just one small rain has caused major problems. How does Public Works or the team address this problem in a timely manner? We're supposed to get another rainstorm Tuesday, according to John Lindsay. The problem is needs to be addressed in a time
to better refine the plan. And maybe take some recommendations from the public. In other words, don't just stamp staff's recommendation. I'd like to know how the water conservation implementation plan dovetails with the groundwater management plan that's been a very long process, sort of wrangled out by our ISJ participants. The ISJ participants have been at this for some time. I understand that it's still 4 to 6 months from seeing a final product or even the draft groundwater management plan. Without that plan, we are left without knowing how to better direct our resources. And when I spell resources in this context, I use a dollar sign. These are the ratepayers' dollars that are going towards these plans and then implementation of them. We want the best plan, and we want to be able to optimize the use of that money. The ISJ has been a cloak of litigation. You haven't had the benefit of the public participating, and we have much to bring. In March of this year, the Los Osos Community Services District Board gave $35,000 to the process with a sort of a deadline that they strapped on it, saying we want the plan by the end of March. And that was Mr. Ogren. I remember sitting here chuckling at the suggestion that they could maybe hold the plan hostage by using some of this money. The negotiations or the The plan itself broke down. The ISJ broke down because of the backdoor deal made by the county, by your staff, with the school district. This is bad faith. And we're just now maybe recovering from that. That's the report we got from legal counsel in Los Osos. And that's the tragedy of it. Water conservation isn't taking place. Good water management isn't taking place. And I want you to look at the whole picture next week when we do talk about the conservation
plan. Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Dr. C. Hyde, followed by Lindy Owen.
Dr. C. Hyde, Los Osos Rural Community Workshop. And, Mr. Chair, I sent you a significant amount of research coming from the PG&E's website, the NOAA website, other websites to back up my arguments. And I'm wondering at what point this board is going to let the Coastal Commission know that the town of Los Osos is already a disadvantaged community and the seismic testing is going to make it very questionable that there's going to be any kind of environmental justice for the people. 15 arguments against seismic testing. Number one, there have been no scientific studies of adverse effects on the wildlife from the 2011 seismic testing throughout Los Osos and the county of San Luis Obispo. Two, there's been no scientific release of data from this 2011 seismic ground testing. Three, it would be prudent for PG&E to compile the data from the ground seismic testing first to see if shoreline, estuary, and offshore seismic testing is necessary. Four, PG&E should be required to release the scientific information on the low-energy seismic research off portions of the California coast before proceeding with a controversial high-decibel seismic study. Five, further seismic studies should not be allowed to proceed without guidelines. NOAA has yet to develop marine mammal acoustic guidelines. Six, San Luis Obispo County has no marine mammal stranding network to report to. Our closest is Goleta and Santa Barbara. Seven, the nitrogen hot fertilizer of organic flotsam from the seismic study take will clog the cooling water intake of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant, making it unreliable. Number eight, PG&E will be acting against its own stated commitment to the environment for the purpose of extending the license of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. Nine, PG&E Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant is aged, scheduled for decommission, and is unreliable. Do you know that they shut down on the 11th for an electrical glitch? 15, the coastal ratepayers had no vote on paying for the seismic study and have no vote to shut down the plant, as did the Sacramento ratepayers. Please read what we did to shut down Rancho Seco. Number 11, continue seismic study as specific to ensuring that Diablo Canyon continue by not just extending the lifespan but providing an afterlife to Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. 12, we have no comparisons to see if similar testing by oil companies have used the similar testing safely because not all have taken the same multiple
in the Bay News. They're busy running around potholing all over town, and today I hit a couple of those, and those potholes, to find the utilities, are now potholes which will destroy your car. DigLosOsos.com. What's the matter with that website, Mr. Gibson, and why are we getting no information in Los Osos? This is a $200 million project. We're spending $7 million for them to give us information, and we have zero. Could you do something about that, please? And to go on about your concern about the hungry people in this county, why did you support?
Address your
comment. Excuse me. Why did Mr. Gibson support that we choose the most expensive technology and the most dangerous technology to put in the piping for our system? Again, we got a major conflict of interest with this county owning Nacimiento water that they need to get rid of. I've got the document from 2008 that suggests that for under $50 million, we could have Nacimiento sent out to Los Osos. Mr. Gibson said that by the time the project is finished, we will have a magic water supply. That magic water supply must be Nacimiento, but not anybody in Los Osos understands that the conflict of interest with this project, as Ben DeFada spoke, the Tonini spray fields. What was that about? taking all of our treated water and dumping it outside of our basin. We spent $4 million in 1 year to find out that that was absolute stupidity. These are supposed to be professional engineers designing this project. All they're doing is basically designing how to waste our water. Current disposal plan, 400 million gallons a day for Broderson, it's not going to work. I want you to look at the dewatering pictures. They were going to show them. I have a picture. This first picture was, this was a 12-minute rain event. Second picture was a five-hour rain event. This is supposed to be a basin. This is the money, this was supposed to hold all of the runoff, the 365 acres of runoff, but it's also supposed to hold the rain, the 8 million gallons a day. Show me a basin here.
Thank you, Ms. Owen.
Thank you.
Richard Margetson, followed by Al Barrow. Mr. Margetson?
I have something I'm trying to get on the overhead. Richard Margetson, last week during two agenda items you had, I questioned this statement in a report, and after the second time I questioned it, county staff said that they would look into it, and if adjustments needed to be made, they would make it. I would have been fine with that. But after the second agenda item, Mr. Gibson took it upon himself to go after me about this statement. I'm going to read the statement, even though it's on the overhead. During fiscal year 2011-2012, the department received 137 retrofit forms. 65 dwelling units needed to be retrofitted, representing a savings of approximately 6 acre-feet per year. I did the calculation, and the calculation came out to that worked out to 82.4 gallons per dwelling unit of water savings. I didn't believe that was accurate. I still don't believe it's accurate. I've actually been in contact with the person who's considered the water conservation expert in this county. He doesn't believe the number's anywhere near that. Mr. Gibson went after me about this calculation. He stated that he had run on his calculator using other assumptions and come up with a different number. I want Mr. Gibson to tell us which of the four constants in this equation would be considered assumptions. Will you change it, Glenn? Does the report not say that 6 acre-feet were saved? Are there not 325,851 gallons in an acre-foot? Were there not 65 dwelling units identified in the report? And are there not 365 days in a year? Tell me which one of those Mr. Gibson thought was a variable that could have been changed. But instead, lashed out at me about this, questioning this ordinance, and stated that my comments in the past have been inconsequential. Well, he actually was talking about the wrong ordinance. This ordinance dealt with Title VIII. The ordinance that I had problems with over the years was Title 19.
But you need to get here early and give it to staff so they can get it programmed, not interrupt the meeting.
I just happened to bike in today to save gas.
Well, that's good. You need to start a little earlier. But you don't interrupt the middle of the meeting and have staff attend to any videos that you have. If you want to show this next week, you're welcome to, but give it to staff before the meeting starts.
You want
to
cover up what's going on, that's on you, that's not on me. But that's all the pictures of the flooding, okay,
that's
of the flooding,
yeah,
of the crummy site that you picked to put the recharge water on, and you put the dewatering of the trenches on. You understand what I'm saying here?
Yeah.
My name is Barrow. I live in Los Osos, and I'm a ratepayer.
Fine.
And the site, the Tri-W site, is not restored. It's being destroyed. And I have a picture of what the site was like when it was a bowl on there. But but you don't want the public to see it.
No, you're welcome to bring it, but you don't interrupt.
Let me tell you something, mister. You let everybody else show their stuff, no big deal. I'll show it sometime. I'll show it today. I'll show it at another part of this meeting.
Well, we'll see.
Well, maybe we will and maybe we won't, but I can tell you this. Your project sucks. Major sucks. Your project sucks. It's so expensive, it's so disruptive, and it's so destroying of our town, the fabric of our community. I'm an affordable housing advocate. You have on your agenda today that 40% of the people in this community go to bed hungry sometimes. That's on your agenda. So, Mr. Gibson...
Mr. Barrow.
Excuse me. I can call whoever I want to, whatever I want to. I'm talking to you. But Mr. Gibson is the one that tried to force reverse osmosis, a really expensive, wasteful electrical project, energy project, on his town in Cambria. And they wouldn't have it. But you have been able to hook us with this rotten project. And the more we see of it, the worse we know it is. We already knew it was going to happen this way. I went by the 10th and 11th Street, and they had a small excavation on the street. They couldn't do anything because they had water in their trench. Duh! When it rains, you're going to have water in your trench. Even if it doesn't rain, if you have pushed water, you have water in your trench. You don't have anywhere to put that dewatering water. 10 years of drinking water supply. You're going to waste it. And Mr. Gibson's all for that? The citizens of Los Osos are being cheated and robbed. You're not even getting decent technology. You're getting a $200 million project that's not going to do what you say it is. And you're not going to recharge our basin. And as Ms. Owens said, recharging the water at Broderson isn't going to do any good because you're putting it right into the saltwater intrusion stream. Mr. Margeson just got up and said the conservation isn't working. What part of your project is working? Can you please tell me that, Mr. Patterson? Do you have any pride in yourself at all?
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. That concludes my request to speak during public comment this morning. There are a couple of issues that I want to follow up on.
I'd like to have my document, please.
No, Mr. Barrow?
My document?
It's right here.
Yeah, well, you should have offered it to me before.
We have a couple of items we want to follow up on. Supervisor Gibson, did you...
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Staff did indicate that they were going to track down Mr. Margetson's questions. I see appropriate staff here. If they would please respond to his questions regarding the retrofit upon sale ordinance. Thank you, Mr. Wolfen.
Thank you, Mike Wilkin, planning and building staff. Last week, the department presented our annual report on the general plan, and in that was a report on the water savings from the Title VIII retrofit upon sale ordinance. And there was testimony at that meeting and afterwards and today again that there was an error in the calculation. So we went back and we reviewed all the retrofit forms that we had received during the fiscal year 11-12. And we went through all the calculations, and what we found was that there were 146 retrofit verification forms. 61 dwellings needed to be retrofitted, and that...
Mr. Margetson, excuse me. Please don't interrupt. Please don't interrupt, or I'll ask you to leave the chambers. Okay, Mr. Wilkin, thank you.
So we found that upon review, there were 146 retrofit forms, 61 dwellings needed to be retrofitted, and that totaled an estimated savings of about 2.5 acre feet per year. So I apologize for the error that was in the report. But
conservation going there. And I would ask staff to double and triple check their calculations before we come to the board, simply so we can save some time and get ourselves to the right point at the first time. Thank you very much.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I wanted to follow up on a couple of things. The state ledge platform, we do have a report coming to us, I believe, on the 23rd. And I'm curious, Mr. Buckshaw, do we have any updates on our federal ledge platform, or do you know when we'll be revisiting that?
Yeah, actually, October 30th is what is scheduled for the state platform.
Okay.
And at that point in time, similar to what we've done in prior years, our state lobbyists, Paul Yoder and Karen Lang, will be here to provide an update on activities at the state, sort of a year-end report from the legislative session, and then also take input from the public, from your board, from county departments and others as well about updating the platform for the upcoming year, and they'll come back in around February timeframe, give or take, with that updated information. And then the federal platform is tentatively scheduled for December 3rd, if memory serves me correctly. It's one of the early December board meetings.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And regarding the staff report on the seismic study that we will be hearing on October 30th. Supervisor Gibson, myself, and the county administrator's office will be working on that staff report, and it will be available to the public no later than October 24th, which is a week from tomorrow. And anything that we include in that report will have to be submitted by October 19th, which is this Friday. So anyone wanting to submit materials, no guarantee that it'll necessarily be included, but we will have an opportunity to review it. It must be in to the county administrator's office by October 19th. Supervisor Gibson.
And we had talked, thank you, Mr. Chairman, we had talked with Mr. Buckshaw about website access to materials that have previously been discussed. Could you tell us where we are on that, Mr. B?
Yeah, we've been gathering that information. I'm anticipating it should be up by the end of the day today or early tomorrow.
And where within the...
It will be on the main website in the What's New section right at the top, and will be a link to additional information.
Okay, so they'll see a reference to it on the homepage?
That's correct. Okay.
And if you could just, when you get that going, notify all five of our offices so that if anybody has trouble, they can call our office if no other place and find out where to go.
Absolutely.
Thank you, sir.
Supervisor Meacham.
Thanks. Just a couple of things. And first of all, I wanted to compliment Second District on the raising of the funds for the Cambria Library. Apparently, they have reached their goal, and I thought maybe you would bring that up.
Well, I was
your supervisor, but
we're getting there. We're going to have our board comments after break.
Well, here's another one, and I want to find out a little bit more. At what point will we be further discussing the ISJ in terms of where that stands and how we're progressing with that? Yeah. We hear a lot of comment about that, and I'm a little curious as to know where we are and when we're going to be talking about that. Thanks.
My thought on that, Mr. Meacham, would be, as it is litigation, we can get an update in closed session. I do believe that we do need we need to keep on this. We'll get appropriate staff to give us that, and I'm sure that the chair, counsel, the administrator all know that that's something that's of importance to us.
Very good. Thank you. With that, we're going to take a short break and reconvene at 11:15. Very good. Thank you, Madam Clerk. We will convene our meeting of this morning. And the next item up is something that we do monthly, an opportunity for each of us to inform the others as well as the public about any of the other commissions or organizations where we represent the Board of Supervisors to give a brief update on that, if there is any, and we'll start with Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Meacham introduced the item, and I did want to comment about the Cambria Library. It's been my pleasure over the course of some years, but particularly over the course of this year, to work with the Friends of the Cambria Library on their fundraising effort in pursuit of and in support of a new branch library in Cambria. And I'm just incredibly pleased to announce that as of yesterday, we got the official word from our library director, Mr. Reynolds, who was here earlier, that they certify that the Friends have met their fundraising goal of $1.4 million. And that comes out of the county policy of projects on new libraries or new library extensions are the capital costs of those projects are borne half by celebrating that. I want to add my thanks to my colleagues, three of whom to my right here were here when they agreed to support this idea by going out in front and securing a building, essentially advancing the Friends their share of the cost of this to secure the site for this a couple years ago. And I'm just so happy that the Friends have repaid that confidence in the way that they have. And thank you, gentlemen, for your support.
Very good. That is indeed good news. Supervisor Gibson, we're happy to share on that with you. And thanks to the Friends in Cambria. Supervisor Hill, any?
Just a quick announcement. Mr. Chair, you may recall that about a year ago, this board sent a letter to our Assemblyman, Asagian, in support of a memorial highway sign for Christopher Meadows, who was a young paramedic that was tragically killed a few years back on the dunes. And happily, this a lot of hard work, especially on behalf of Tim Meadows, the dad, and Cacho in his office. And next Friday, on October 26th at 10:30, there'll be a ceremony over on the Madonna Meadow by, you know, near the Madonna Inn, by the path there that you see from the freeway, because there will be a sign put up honoring in that area going in my district towards the south, honoring Christopher Meadows. So that's next Friday, the 26th at 10:30 a.m. There'll be a short ceremony, and I think it's a good thing that's occurred.
Okay. Thank you, Supervisor Hill. Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I didn't mean to steal your thunder there, Mr. Gibson. I didn't realize we were going to be getting into this. I thought we did this last week. But at any rate, 2 weeks ago I did attend a LAFCO conference, which was very informative and one that I think a lot of folks might want to be paying close attention to in the years to come, because there's going to be a lot of determinations made there, I think, that will have a strong influence on what cities and counties do. Other than that, this weekend they are having a historical symposium that's coming through San Luis County. It'll be in Tascadero and Templeton and Paso Robles. I've been asked to speak on Saturday at the Pioneer Museum about some local history, so it'll be fun.
Okay, and Supervisor Meacham, if you might just mention what LAFCO is, too.
The Local Agency Formation Commission. It is an organization that determines spheres of influence, annexations, community districts. There's a variety of things that they're involved in, and two of our members are on the LAFCO board now. I'm an alternate to that board. And you have representations from some of the cities, as well as an at-large member from the communities. And that person has to be chosen, I guess, because we have one that is now leaving.
Very good. Thank you for that. Supervisor, to share any updates?
Yes, I do, Chairman Patterson. And first, I'd like to congratulate Supervisor Gibson and the people of District 2 for meeting their goal on the library in Cambria. It's a huge endeavor, one we went through in Napomo a number of years ago, and I wish anybody well on that's taking that on, because I know the commitment that it takes. But I'd like to comment on the SCAT board, which is a South County Area Transit that I serve on. And this past summer, they, along with RTA, which is a regional transit authority, had a free summer pass for all kids K through 12. Hugely successful program, more so in the South County than with RTA. They had a 400% increase in ridership, if you can believe that. And when all the numbers came in, it came in to about 7 cents a person to put them on the road, which I thought was a greatly successful campaign. My hat's off to Jeff Straw and his staff for pulling it off, and I think it's something that'll head us in the right direction. And with Rideshare Month being this month, I just wanted to add that to the mix. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Supervisor, to share. And I just have a couple of announcements I want to share, and these are programs that relate to our homeless efforts here in San Luis Obispo County. The first event we have coming up on Thursday, October 25th, at the Community Church in Atascadero, and it's co-sponsored by the Community Church in Atascadero, as well as the Homeless Services Coalition of the North County and the Homeless Services Oversight Commission. And we will be showing the film Homeless, Not Hopeless, as well as convening a panel with representatives who are either currently homeless or have been homeless to share their experience. And we'll have representatives also from a variety of service organizations from throughout the county, including the El Camino Homeless Organization. The LINC, which is a family resource center, will close our board comments and move on in the agenda. And I'll ask the clerk to read the next item, please, to introduce it.
Item number 31, a hearing to consider an ordinance amending Chapter 3.08, Transient Occupancy Tax, of Title III, Revenue and Finance of the County Code to amend and update in order to streamline the remittance of county funds, allow the recovery of collection costs, simplify the hearing and appeal process, and clarify existing policies and procedures. All districts. Item was introduced on September 25th, 2012.
Very good. Thank you. And Mr. Cooley, you'll be giving the staff presentation?
Yes. Good morning, Chairman Patterson and members of the board. My name is Justin Cooley. I'm from the Treasurer Tax Collector Public Administrator's Office. And this is a hearing to consider adopting an ordinance to Chapter 3.08 on transient occupancy tax of the county code. I would note first that on the advice of the clerk, we have a clarification to the recommendation. I'd like to read that. We're recommending that your board adopt the proposed ordinance in order to amend Chapter 3.08, Transient Occupancy Tax, of Title III, Revenue and Finance, to amend and update in order to streamline the remittance of county funds, allow for the recovery of collection costs, and simplify the hearing and appeal process, and clarify existing policies and procedures. Should your board approve this ordinance, we would recommend that you authorize the clerk to publish a summary in a newspaper of general circulation within 15 days after the adoption of the proposed ordinance by your board. Okay, so first a little background on TOT. It is a tax on lodging establishment guests. TOT is collected from the guest by the lodging operator, who then holds it in trust for the county to remit to the county. And in the last fiscal year, over $6 million in TOT was collected by approximately 860 operators. Okay. So what we're recommending, what we're having this ordinance here, are several improvements that I'd like to highlight. First, it would provide explicitly for streamlined remittance, particularly through the tax collector's new website, which allows for electronic filing and remittance of TOT and business license, by the way. That will make it available to the operators 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Another item is that as transient occupancy tax is an unsecured tax, this amendment would allow the
Let's see if...
Is that better? Okay. As TOT is an unsecured tax, this amendment would allow the recovery of delinquent collections costs under the existing unsecured delinquent collections fee. This fee is approved yearly by your board. Based on our current delinquency rates, it's anticipated this would affect less than 1% of all operators. This would also provide for a streamlined reconsideration process. What this means is that under the current ordinance, it provides that an operator who disagrees with the decision of the tax collector, and that could be about estimated taxes or imposition of penalties or fees, is the remedy is to appeal directly to the board. In practice, what has been done is that we've been very successful in resolving most issues at the level of the tax collector. What would change in this amendment is it would provide explicitly for that reconsideration in front of the tax collector. Although, if they disagree with that reconsideration, they still retain all the options of appealing directly to your board. So there's no diminishment of the due process rights there. Lastly, there's several items in here that clarify existing practices. These practices mostly come from prior board decisions, recommendations from county council, and the best practices as included in the tax collector's reference manual that's published by the state controller's office. We believe that the improvements provided, should your board adopt this ordinance, will result in better service to the lodging operators and more efficient process for the county. And at this time, I would ask if there are any questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cooley. Any questions from my colleagues for staff? That's interesting. I don't see any, and I will at this point open it to the public for public comment on this item. I have no request to speak, so I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. Supervisor Gibson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was waiting to see if there was public comment on this. I guess the only thought that revolves in with me is, could you clarify exactly under what conditions a TOT certificate can be revoked under this ordinance, and what's the consequence of not having a TOT certificate, for instance, if you're a vacation rental, which is one that's come up in
right times. Under the current ordinance, this really doesn't change. A TOT certificate is required along with a business license whenever you are operating any sort of establishment engaged in short-term rentals, and we define that as 30 days or less. Essentially, it can be...
You got it.
Waive the reading.
Waive the reading, yes.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure part of your motion was to waive the reading. Thank you.
I'm waiving the reading.
What do we do? Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
And Mr. Patterson?
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was easy going.
Easy, but...
Madam Clerk, would you introduce the next item, please?
Item number 32, a hearing to consider an appeal by Plains Exploration and Production Company of public facilities fees on various building permits, District 3. Item continued to October 30th, 2012.
Mr. Jansen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board, Matt Jansen, planning staff. We need to continue this item to October 30th. I was hoping to have it ready for discussion today. However, it is not, and it may not even be ready for October 30th, but we'll talk more about that on October 30th. It's getting more complex the more I dig into it, and I want to bring it to you as resolved as possible. So I've talked to PXP, and we're going to possibly continue it off calendar, but we'll talk more about that on the 30th. So
okay.
I'm just not ready for prime time yet on this one.
All right, very good. So definitely we will have an opportunity to get into it in a little more detail on the 30th, which may include continuing it off calendar?
Correct.
Okay, very good. You need an action from us. I guess we do, yes. I will open the floor to public comment, but I have no request to speak, so I'll close it to public comment, and I do need a motion to continue this.
Move to continue to October 30th.
Okay.
Second.
All right. Roll call, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
And Mr. Patterson?
Yes. Okay. Would you introduce the next item, please?
Item number 33, consider a request by the County of San Luis Obispo to consider authorizing the processing of amendments to the Land Use Ordinance, Title 22 of the County Code, the Coastal Zone Land Use Ordinance, Title 23 of the County Code, and the Real Property Division Ordinance, Title 21 of the County Code, to modify various sections, including the flood hazard combining designation to comply with the federal law requirements of the Federal Emergency Management Act, FEMA, LRP 2012-00002, all districts.
Mr. Jansen.
Mr. Chair, yeah, for those of you who don't know Nick, this is Nick Forrester. He's been with us for a long time, but he's been on the front lines at the Permit Center. He's one of our ordinance experts, and he'll be presenting the item today.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Jansen. Well, welcome, Mr. Forrester, and we look forward to your presentation.
Good morning, Chairman Patterson and other members of the board. I am Nick Forrester with the County Planning Department, and the item before you this morning is a request by the County of San Luis Obispo to authorize processing of revisions to Titles 22 and 23 of County Code. Specifically, we're requesting authorization to revise the flood hazard combining designation sections of the inland and coastal ordinances to comply with the requirements of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. As you probably know, flood insurance in San Luis Obispo County is available through FEMA at a subsidized rate, and property owners are fortunate enough to be able to take advantage of that subsidized insurance program. FEMA on a regular basis reviews the local ordinances for compliance with federal code. They've recently gone through our ordinance and they've identified several deficiencies which they've instructed the county to correct. Failure to revise the local codes to comply with the federal requirements could result in either suspension or cancellation of the locally available flood insurance through FEMA. Flood insurance is also available through other private companies, but at significantly higher rates, and obviously we would like to avoid that. Staff does recommend that the board authorize the processing of these amendments to Title 22 and 23 of County Code.
Okay, great. Mr. Forster, could you speak just briefly to the process? If should we authorize this, what process planning staff would go through, and the estimated timeline, just to give us an idea?
Absolutely, Chairman Patterson. Should the board choose to authorize these amendments, the next step would be county staff would go back and complete a staff report, complete the necessary environmental review changes. This revision, if adopted by the board, will not affect any of the floodplains that are currently mapped, nor will it affect what can be built in them. It's mostly minor legal technicalities. For instance, FEMA is requesting that we insert a statutory authorization section, citing the Federal Code of Regulations as statutory authority for the section in our local ordinance.
They just, okay. Technical changes, it sounds like, from Mr. Tomlinson.
Yes, Mr. Tomlinson, did you want to speak to that as well?
Yes, the depth to this is, Nick and I have discussed this quite extensively. There aren't really any changes. We're adding things into the ordinance that were referred to in the ordinance before, but not actually within the ordinance. They just want it all in one place, is what it appears. So it doesn't say refer to Public Works to look for this stuff and go someplace else to look for that stuff. It's all just going to be in the ordinance now.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Supervisor Meacham.
Nick, how frequently does FEMA require these updates? I mean, do we review these? How often?
Tim Thompson, Public Works. They review them every time the maps are updated. They review them in 2008 when the maps were updated and approved what we have now. We're getting new maps with some new datum in them on November 16th, which triggers their review of our ordinance.
I see. Thanks, Tim.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Mr. Teixeira.
Thank you. So this is something that they do on a fairly regular basis, and we're not delinquent because of something that laws changed or some new statute that they've passed. I know that there's, with the 9/11 stuff going on with the railroad, there's new easements and regulations for them that we've talked about with our projects in Oceano and some of the flooding and stuff going on there. Just that was my curiosity.
It doesn't relate to any of that stuff. It's we are in fact going to be delinquent, but only because it takes about a year and a half at the minimum to actually do this process, and they told us to do this last April. We spent about 4 months rewriting the ordinances. This is just a lengthy bureaucratic process to get this done. I think they're still going to give us our new maps on the 16th, even though we're not going to be done. I mean, there's no way that these other two hearings are going to occur within the next month. I've told them that, and they haven't threatened us with anything terrible. But, no, this isn't driven by our actions, other than they're giving us new maps, and this is just what happens.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, and I was actually informed that once it was authorized, then we were okay. That's what I was told.
They haven't said that in writing anywhere, but I think that's going to be the case.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Any further questions from my colleagues? I see none. I'll open it to the public for public comment on this item, but I have no request to speak, so I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board for action.
Move staff's recommendation.
Second.
Okay. Madam Clerk, roll call, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Forster. We will move on to the next item on our agenda this morning. And I'll ask the clerk to introduce that item, please.
Item number 34, presentation and strategic planning on fiber optic availability within San Luis Obispo County.
Okay. Very good. Mr. Savage, you will be presenting this for us.
I will. Good morning, Board. Guy Savage with Information Technology, part of your General Services Agency. This morning, we have a strategic planning item. It'll be a bit of a discussion after the presentation I give. Plenty of time for you to talk about fiber optics. I didn't bring any props with me this time, but this presentation is a follow-up to a presentation I gave back in February of 2011. Waited till now to come back to your board because, if you recall, back on September 25th, you approved an MOU with the Nacimiento Water Project. So I figured this was a good time to come back, talk about fiber in general now that we have that MOU in place. Before I get started, I did want to wish your board a happy Bosses Day. Today is National Bosses Day, in case you didn't know. One of those little quirks that happens in our calendars happens to be October 16th every year. So to all the bosses out there, happy Bosses Day. All right, so let's go ahead and jump right in. Communications, of course, we've been communicating for a long, long, long time. If we go back far enough, you know, we use things like smoke signals, and then we moved on to things like the telegraph, and then those good old black phones. I think there's still some of those running around. Of course, today we look at these smartphones, and that's what we think of often when we think about communications. When we think about how we transport the information that we're using, you know, again, if you go back far enough, there's things like the Pony Express, and along with those telephones came telephone wires, and today we'll see these towers for our cell phones and so on. But most people want something that looks like this, a wireless connection anywhere they go, everywhere they go, and gets wet. You don't have to worry about it. Electrical noise, meaning interference from other technologies, for instance, wireless technologies, you don't have to worry about those sorts of things. And most importantly, it doesn't corrode, unlike, again, like copper. It's green. I think that's a good point about fiber. It's made mostly from sand, silica. It's small and lightweight. You got a firsthand picture of that last time. And I'll talk more about this next bullet, but over fiber, we can push more data. And, you know, all those things that we talk about related to data, whether it's your voicemail, your voice conversations, PC data, so on and so forth, that's all data that we're pushing across these networks. And last but not least, it's got the best return on investment for a network. And, of course, that's, you know, if you were to build out a copper infrastructure, which we've been doing for years and years and years, those telephone lines, those are all copper-based technologies. If you switch to fiber, from a cost perspective, it's a much more efficient and effective way to transmit more data. So this is probably the biggest question I've had since my last presentation. A couple of the board members asked this question. I've been stopped on the street. People have asked me this question. They say, well, how does fiber really work, Guy? How do you do that? So basically, for those who aren't electrical engineers, fiber uses the same technologies we've been using for years for any digital communication. And think of a digital communication, often we think about those ones and zeros, meaning a switch is either on or off. And we're communicating digitally with those sorts of things. It's the same basic approach. So in this case, we often use, as the picture at the bottom there shows, an electrical pulse comes into a device that's on one end of the network. We convert it to light. We shoot that light through the fiber. We convert it back to a digital pulse on the other side or an electronic pulse on the other side, and we can read it. Just like we sent it, we could read it on the other end. In the middle of the picture here, it's probably hard for you guys to see on your little screens there, but in the middle of that fiber optic cable, I've got some different colors. And one of the ways we send more information across fiber optic lines is to shoot more and different light waves through that fiber. As it says here, that light then travels basically at the speed of light. And so therefore, we can push more data over longer distances than other technologies. To give you a feel for this, again, I've been talking about copper, for instance, those telephone lines we all use. How much data can you really push over one of those existing copper lines? Well, if you think about how far you can reasonably push data over a copper line, people often look at, you know, we talk about things like megabits, and I'm going to get to this in a second. But we talk about how many megabits could I push over, say, a couple of miles. Well, with fiber, we don't talk about megabits. We talk about a measurement that's 1,000 times that big. We talk about gigabits. We don't talk about a couple of miles. We talk about hundreds of miles. So instead of pushing a small amount of data a couple of miles, we can push 1,000 times as much data several hundred miles. So if you think about how we interconnect all of these data networks, it's that fiber at the backbone, that infrastructure that we're trying to build, the great challenge for the 21st century that we're using to push all that data. So when we think about fiber, and we often hear this phrase, broadband. And well, what is broadband? I introduced it last time in February. Most people, when they think about broadband, they think about what they get at home. What's my broadband ability at home? And as it says on this slide, you know, that means I can download 4 megabits per second, and I can upload about 1 megabit of data per second. How much is a megabit? Well, we can get into the details of that. I'm going to skip that for now, but just suffice it to think about when you take a picture with your camera, right? You often think of a 10-meg camera. So think of how long it takes to upload a picture as opposed to download a picture. Generally speaking, when you're downloading those pictures from the internet, they come down very fast. When you're trying to upload one to Facebook or whatever your favorite picture-sharing mechanism is, it's a much slower operation. Behind all of that, making that communication happen, is fiber. So I grabbed some statistics off the internet. Well, I don't know if that makes them 100% true, but I think in this case they are true. When we talk about mobile broadband, so those cellular phones that we all use, remember, that data goes through the airwaves, and eventually it gets onto a data network. Somewhere behind all of that, there's a data network. So 80% of the population will have mobile broadband by 2016. What's going to enable that? Fiber. About 50% of the U.S. population today has a smartphone. I imagine most of the board members have a smartphone. There's about 350 million Facebook users a day. Again, they're all sharing pictures, their latest status, so on and so forth. What supports all of that? Fiber. This was an interesting one to me. When we think about the core networks we're used to using, meaning or seeing the ABCs, the NBCs, those sorts of television networks, in one day, there's enough content, meaning video clips and so on and so forth, in one day, that tablet devices, we're all using these same networks to communicate. So let's talk about what this means to the citizens in our great county. Nationally, about 80% of all citizens are connected. Here in San Luis Obispo, that number is a little higher. We're a little closer to 85%, but there's still 40,000 citizens that don't have access in any way to a broadband access, essentially. That data comes from an FCC Broadband Commission study that came out earlier this year. I think the next bullet is pretty obvious to all of us. You know, Americans do spend more time online than watching TV, you know, the Facebooks I mentioned, Twitters, Skype, playing games, shopping, watching TV these days. I don't know how many of you switched to a YouTube feed on Sunday so you could watch the guy fall from the sky, but I noticed my CNN feed, they cut off. So I jumped off the network, my network feed, and went over YouTube to watch it happen with only a 20-second delay. Again, that was all coming to me live over some network, whereas I couldn't get it from the television networks. And then I put this little graph at the bottom here just to give people a feel, because they said, well, Guy, how does my old modem, remember the funny sound, you put your phone in the cradle, you know, it's way on the left there. I showed it as in that red band. And then people will say, well, what about satellite? Is that a broadband technology? Generally speaking, no. It does provide folks in remote rural areas access to networks. DSL and cable, that's kind of the bottom end, typically, of the broadband technologies. But then when we get to fiber, clearly that's the fastest, and that's a full broadband network. All right, so flipping then from citizens to the business side, I wanted to provide some sort of a graph of, you know, what is it that businesses need as opposed to the individual citizen? So if you can see it on this slide, there's a little bitty red dot in the middle, and that red dot represents essentially what a broadband connection looks like. You might be able to support a very small office on a broadband connection, 4 to 8 people, you know, sending the occasional email, looking up something on the internet, that sort of thing. Clearly, if you have a larger office, that's not nearly good enough. The yellow circle in the middle there, that's the county's connection to the internet. It's about a 40 meg connection. We don't need much more connection than that, because remember, we're not doing the kinds of things that some high-tech companies do We don't share large videos typically other than the board meeting that gets streamed, so we don't need as big a connection as some businesses. And then when you think about our county backbone, meaning if I were to send you an email, that's a 1 gig pipe, so that's a big connection. That's where a lot of businesses would like to be, a full 1 gig connection to their business, to everything around them. And I think that's where fiber will allow us to go. As I said here, you know, businesses need faster upload and download, and they need it constantly. Unlike you and me, we might be willing to wait a few seconds for something to download. If it's critical to your business, you can't wait. So it's important that they get those large data sets, whether it's images, videos, maps, what have you, down very quickly. So a little bit about fiber across the county. Obviously, and I said this in my last presentation, fiber saves money for us as a county, because it allows us to be more efficient, allows the citizens to interact with us a little better, and, of course, it saves time and money for businesses. It is an economic development driver. You heard other things this morning as part of your presentations that are also economic development drivers, and there's some folks in the audience here, I think, that may talk to this piece. It's core to our public safety network. If you want to get a fire truck out to your house, you know, that information traverses fiber optic network. Of course, education, it's key for education. We talked earlier about a library, all of our libraries, we're trying to get them connected via fiber. And of course, when you talk about enhanced services, and what I mean by that is, let's say you were to go over to the hospital and they have some sort of image, you know, of a broken arm or something, and you want to be able to get somebody to verify what happened to that person's arm. Well, using fiber networks, they can send that information to maybe an expert who's used to reading x-rays or MRI results. And the way that happens is we send it over a network. The guy remotely can quickly look at it and get back to you right away, and then they know how to treat that broken arm. More recently, for us, we actually had an opportunity to interact with the Cal Poly Technology Park. They were trying to bring up a new building, and they said, you know, we really need a fiber connection, or this technology center, we won't be able to get it off the ground. We had some fiber in the area. We were able to temporarily hook them up. It got the technology park off on the right foot on the day they wanted, and over time they've gone back to some other networks and off of the county's fiber. But it's just a good example, I think, of how we can be flexible with fiber if we've got it in a nearby neighborhood. So I brought this up for just a minute. I think we all remember the Google hype, right? Let's hope this comes up as expected. This is where I need sound. Can you guys hear that? Come on. Let's try that again. I'm going to skip those speeches, but for those who didn't know, Google actually selected Kansas City, Kansas as their site for putting in fiber. And actually, I think it's a good representation of why building out fiber in San Luis Obispo County is so difficult. We have mountains. They have a lot of flat land. So going across flat land is a pretty straightforward and easy thing to do. When you look at our topography here in this county, it's not quite that flat. So getting from point A to point B can be a little more difficult. So as I said here at the bottom of the slide, I think the solution for us is to leverage what we have in place. So let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, for those who don't know, we do have a strategic plan from the county's perspective, solely the county's perspective, out on our county website. It's been there for some time. I do get occasional questions and comments about it. But our basic backbone, meaning the core portions of our fiber optic network, they're built on three separate approaches. We've negotiated as different private carriers have come through town. For instance, you may all recall the Level 3 negotiations and everything that happened with that. That gave us one backbone that basically follows the railroad tracks from the southern portions of the county all the way up to the northern part. We also participate in something called the UMAN, the Unified Metropolitan Area Network. That's a collaboration with the SLO County Office of Education and some others, such as Cal Poly. And then most recently, of course, the Nacimiento Water Project Partnership. Off of those backbones, we often build, much like we do with sewers and other things, what we call laterals, meaning you've got the core system going down the middle, and we build a small lateral off the side that allows us to connect up things. Historically and today, we're still primarily focused on a county-funded approach to building those laterals. Occasionally, as it says here, we'll partner with other government and educational entities, but most of that view has been us doing it on our own. Now, in the audience today is some folks from the EVC. I know that they've got a grant proposal out there for the Economic Development Administration to be able to do a little more pooling of knowledge about what fiber's in the ground, and maybe the county has a role in that. Maybe we don't. That's the proposed piece by the EVC. But the county could then have an overview of what all the fiber is that's out there. And then instead of, for instance, us going down one street and somebody else going down two streets over, we'd know, well, hey, there's an asset here. Infrastructure already built. Let's leverage what's already in place. Okay, so in front of you, you have a piece of paper. I realized on those small screens you can't read what's on the screen here. And I include this in the presentation just to give people a feel for how much fiber is in place. If you can see this, there's little yellow and black kind of lines. That's either UMAN fiber or some of those private carrier partnership fiber infrastructures. As you can see, it covers the south part of the county and central part of the county very well. As we head up toward the north, we don't have a whole lot of partnerships in place. The blue line coming down the middle there is the Nacimiento Water Project fiber. So we have these assets that head north, but we haven't really expanded the use very much in the north county. I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. So what are some of the opportunities that are out there? Of course, we can always create public-to-public partnerships, and we're talking about doing this in lots of places. For instance, we're talking about using the Nacimiento Water Project fiber to do something with the federal government. One of the military units needs to get up to the fort in southern Monterey County there. So we're talking about how we might be able to do that. But there are other ways for us to leverage the fiber we have in place so that other agencies don't have to build out the same infrastructure. As it says here, law enforcement agencies pretty much have to connect to us to get things like CLETS, which is the California Law Enforcement Terminal System. So in other words, if they want to look up somebody online, see if they're a felon, what have you, they connect to the county and then to Sacramento because we're the trusted connection to Sacramento. Unfortunately, with the cities, there's very little interconnection between our infrastructure and what they have. Yes, we connect to things like libraries where the city might also have a presence, but we don't really collaborate very well when it comes to the and Nacimiento Water Project plants. The city would like to connect all of that, and we are talking about this particular connection. As you can see here, they might have to build one line from City Hall and maybe two other lines to get to the water projects, but we would share that same red line. So by doing that, we can leverage costs and not both of us build the same thing. Similarly, you've got folks like the Superior Court who are in Paso Robles. They have to connect to us in order to get to the state. Well, all they need is that red line and the green line. So here you can see we begin saving costs by sharing. And the last but not least, you've got the schools in Paso Robles that I think would be a great conversation because all those little purple flagged buildings are schools. You can quickly see by leveraging both of our fiber, the county's fiber infrastructure, they can quickly connect or much more cost-effectively connect to each other. Another good example, just real quick, I think down in Grover Beach, most of us are aware of the Amtrak Multimodal Center that's being built down there. Well, there's another place that wants to connect to be able to get to the Internet and allow people Wi-Fi and that sort of thing while they're sitting there waiting for their train or their bus or what have you. At the same time, the county has fiber down there just off the rail tracks by Highway 1, and we want to be able to get over to the center that's on the far right of this picture, listed as D there. It's where the courts are and some other county buildings, health center. So what if we were to share with those same agencies and the city of Grover to get all the way across? Now, in reality, it might be a private sector company that helps us make that happen, but at least we're sharing the costs of all the fiber infrastructure and, most importantly, not building redundant systems that we don't really need. So the other side of that, that was the public-to-public, you know, government-to-government sort of an opportunity. Here's an example or some thoughts about how we might do some public-to-private enterprise partnerships. We've talked a lot about the Nascimento Water Project fiber, and in particular the spare conduit that was constructed along with that. It's sitting there empty. There are a number of companies that would love to be able to get from the city of San Luis Obispo up to the North County. That mountain range, Cuesta Grade, creates a great barrier that makes it very difficult for them to get from this side of the mountain to the other side because there's just not enough space in conduit or other cost-effective ways to build a fiber line from this side to that side. So one concept might be to use the spare conduit, form some sort of consortium of private vendors that want to participate, allow them to use the conduit, put fiber in it, and that would mean potentially revenue to the county and to the district that originally built the water pipeline. Another way that we might consider public-private partnerships is one that Caltrans has done in some areas, and that is they've kind of put into place this what they call a dig ordinance. And basically what that says is every time you're going to tear up the street, you post it on some website, and the local purveyors that want to put in fiber can see that and say, oh, you know, that's a stretch I want to go down anyway. So while you've got the street all torn up, why don't I go ahead and put in my conduit? As opposed to me coming back 6-8 months after you've just repaved the street, wanting to tear it up so I can put fiber in there. As it says here, it would just allow local vendors to be notified that there's going to be a dig, and then they'd have an opportunity to put fiber and conduit in the hole. That's essentially the approach we took with the Nascimento Water Project. The project was going to be tearing up several, 27 miles? 40 miles of ground, and we said, hey, while you're doing that, let's put some conduit, some fiber in it for the benefit of the county. So here's my kind of call to action slides. I obviously encourage you to talk to the other leaders in your district, whether they're school districts, as I said here with education. There are lots of other organizations, public and private, that would really like to be able to get onto some sort of a fiber network, and some of those costs can be shared. I think one of the biggest benefits for me today out of giving this presentation was I've made a new connection with the EVC, one I didn't have before. And so moving forward, I'll be working more closely with the EVC to help make some of these things happen. As it says, encourage partnerships, whether they're public-public or public-private. And then as we come forward with other ordinances and projects and so on and so forth, support those. Again, wrapping up, the goal we have here is to leverage what we have in place. That's the key. So this presentation is posted down on the county's website under the IT department's presentation subpage. If you have questions of me and you're in the public, you can reach me at informationtechnology@co.caus. And with that, I'll throw it to questions for you all.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Savage. Do we have any questions at this point? From my colleagues. I don't see any. We do have requests to speak from the public, so I'll invite them up. And Mr. Savage, if you'll stand by, maybe some questions will be raised that you can speak to. Public comment request, Mike Brown, followed by Rob Rosales.
Mike Brown representing CoLab. We think this is an exciting opportunity, but one of the things they need is this very large digital pipe, and if that's coming, it could be great. So, you know, I think you've got a tremendous opportunity here. If you can get everybody focused together with the EVC and the county and look at some specific steps. Heck, James Cameron, who made Avatar, lives down in Hollister Ranch, not so far from here, and this is the kind of thing that could be developed, focused, and pushed along. So we hope you could pick that off. Of course, a large university over here, as it grows and has more specialization, is going to need this and has the opportunity to spin off various types of high-tech entities that could be using this. So we hope that you support Mr. Savage, that you do coordinate this, as he said, with the EVC, and try to pick some specific things off and see what could be done.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Brown. Rob Rosales, followed by Christine Rogers.
Thank you. Rob Rosales, Templeton Chamber of Commerce. As was expressed in the February meeting, there's a unique opportunity for our area, for San Luis Obispo and the entire region. You were very excited about that opportunity. I hope you consider pursuing this even further, more so than just a thumbs up, but put some teeth behind your decision and give some staff some direction on this. With regard to our community, as was heard in the presentation, there are conversations going on with Paso Robles. I hope those type conversations are also going on with officials in Templeton. While we don't have a central form of representation there, I hope you will consider giving staff direction to have those conversations with people in Templeton. You know, with regard to education, our schools are some of the best in the county. We want to keep them that way. We want to maintain that. We want all students to excel, not only in our districts, but in the other districts of our schools. A lot of high schools now are offering concurrent enrollment with Cuesta College. I think this would be very beneficial with communicating those and other higher institutes of education. Public health-wise, we have the only inpatient facility for North County is based in Templeton with the Twin Cities Hospital. We have an ever-growing health services sector growing with that. They'd be very, very interested in something like this, very excited about this. I've spoken to this new CEO. He is looking forward to some progress on this, similar to what they have, at, I believe, offered at French Hospital now. They're able to better communicate with facilities at Stanford and UCLA. Regard to public safety, we have the only we have the North County substation there in Templeton for the sheriff's office. We also have the substation for the CHP. So, you know, as was alluded to, those are key entities that we need. And with regard to economics, you know, the job opportunities that this would offer, not only for our area but for the entire region. So again, I hope you have those continue not only to give the thumbs up support, but give some direction to maybe seek grants and things like that with regard to our rural character. I know it's more difficult and more challenging to entice those private entities to do their work and to put their money in and invest in our infrastructure. But I think with that push from the public, they'll be more willing to look at us. So thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Rosales. Christine Rogers, followed by Tim Williams.
Good morning, Chair Patterson, supervisors, and staff. Christine Rogers with the Economic Vitality Corporation. I am very excited to hear that there are multiple projects moving forward that are so well aligned. As you know, in the discussions in the development of the economic strategy, access to broadband was a key priority initiative for those groups. And moving that forward, the EVC recently submitted an application to the Economic Development Administration for a Public Works and Economic Adjustment Assistance grant. The scope of that grant has to do with assessing the existing resources in our county, developing a countywide map, and then looking at opportunities to make those linkages and capitalize on those opportunities. It also has an education and a marketing outreach component, and has been undertaken in partnership with the City of Santa Maria. The City of Santa Maria is also challenged in having adequate fiber and has, you know, a very high unemployment rate, and we are hoping that in working together we might actually make that bridge of fiber across the two counties. So we're very excited, as I said, that all of these things are moving forward together, and we look forward to working with county staff.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tim Williams.
Good afternoon, and thanks for letting me speak. Mr. Savage did a great job of explaining the benefits of fiber, and his presentation was fantastic. I don't need to go into that. If I were to support a little bit more, maybe what Rob Rosales said, is that this could really go well with a push from you to staff. You've got a fantastic staff, and they can run with this and put some opportunities in front of you, but I think a good direct push from the board that says we are interested in expanding this network. It's expensive to build this. The reason we don't have fiber in our region is because it's a very expensive endeavor, and there's not a lot of revenue that can be derived from it. So it's going to take sort of a private-public, public-public partnership to have this happen. So with your push for that, to really look at the opportunities we have, if we're building a new sewer, is this being considered? If we're putting bike paths in, if we're working on county roads, is this being considered as something to be dropped in? And the private sector is going to support this. We're going to come in and pay what we can because it's going to make it less expensive if we work together on things like this. You definitely have, as you know, Digital West has been supporting this all along. We worked with the county for a number of years now. We will support anything you can do to try to help push this along. Last night at the Grover Beach, it was being relatively progressive. It was a 5-0 vote to support a public-private partnership between Digital West and the city of Grover to expand the fiber network throughout their region. They really want to capitalize on this. Eventually it'll happen. I guess if we wait around for 10, 15, 20 years, we don't want to do that. We want to push this and really bring the economic development to the whole county as soon as possible. So anything we can do to support it, appreciate it.
Okay, very good. A question, Mr. Williams? Supervisor Hill.
Tim, could you I know you were involved in the Slow City project. I wonder if you could describe that briefly and perhaps, you know, as you're advocating here, what might we think of that is similar?
Okay. And you mean the public-private partnership with the city? So the city of San Luis Obispo had an empty conduit that wasn't utilized. It was something that was going to help us bring our services to another part, another business district in San Luis Obispo. So we worked together to see how we could utilize this empty conduit that they had. There was essentially a trade of services. We had to work through a couple of things, and it ended up being a pretty difficult process, but that was our first one. After that, it should go a little easier. But what it ended up doing was giving both the city additional connectivity and what they needed. There were little areas that they needed to kind of close the loop on. And as Mr. Savage showed you up in Paso Robles, I'll use that as a great example. They want to get from here to here. And the city and the county want that. Well, so do some of the private entities. You know, a company like ours would look at that and say, we're interested in getting from this part of town to this part of town. Maybe we meander over a street or two to make sure we're filling everybody's needs. And if we can do that, and we were able to provide that for those public entities, maybe there's areas where the public entities have conduit that would help the private entities. So I think there's some advantages there. The San Luis Obispo City one was a good one of that, where they had that empty conduit. We needed to get from here to there, and we were able to work together on that.
So if we were to if you were to advocate specifically something that the county might look into, what would you recommend?
Well, the as Guy mentioned, on their website they have sort of their plan, what the county has. So there are areas where I would call them a wish list. Ultimately, this is where the county would like to be. There are areas. Grover Beach was a good example that he put up there, from one point of the town across over into Rio Grande. Where are other entities like the cities or the county or the other private entities interested in going? And that's one that we're actually wanting to work on directly with the county. But I know there are more of those. There are areas, the Paso Robles example was a good one. Templeton would be a great one. As Rob said, the medical industry there is pretty big. It's just very expensive for us private entity to get over to them. They want it. We want it. It's just a hard part. So if we could work together on those specific ones, and I think they'll just continue. As that map showed, there were some schools that popped up in Paso Robles. The education network is pretty vast in our area, but there are some pretty big holes as well. So if we work together, I think we can fill some of those gaps as we work together.
Yeah. Mr. Williams, do you know how it happened that the city of San Luis Obispo had this conduit? Did they follow one of your suggestions when they repaved the road, they laid the conduit? How did that happen?
This particular one, and I'm probably 95% right on this. This particular one was actually a water conduit because it went from one part of town to another, and it actually goes up. It meanders up to a water tank that's up on the hill. So it was an unused water conduit that they were going to utilize. We can use that for fiber, too. If it's something they're not utilizing and they didn't end up needing it, then it's sort of an excess piece of conduit. And the trade was there were areas that the city wanted to go where they didn't have conduit. So they let us utilize some of theirs. We put in some conduit in other areas so then they could kind of tie all their network together.
Very good. Okay.
Thank you.
Actually, if I might, Mr. Chairman, you spoke about the city of San Luis. You also spoke about Grover Beach. And as I looked on the map, the goal at Grover Beach is rather an extensive piece of ground and some. What's the time frame? What's the commitment? What's on the books that might actually happen in the near future?
Using Grover Beach as an example?
Yeah, you just said the Grover Beach Council.
Okay, yes. So last night the city council gave us a
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've had lengthy discussions with Guy over this topic, and I'm really excited to see the progress that actually has been made. I know for the longest time we've been trying to craft some type of an arrangement whereby we could utilize that spare conduit from the NASMENO for commercial use. And I know we're working towards that. I think one of the biggest questions that I get from most folks is the physical connection, how that's accomplished between different agencies. And I would assume that, as Mr. Rosales said, if Templeton wants to do something like that, there's a two-way deal here. We can present this, but they have to want it, and they have to want to be able to participate in something like that as well. So how do we make those contacts, and how do we describe that physical characteristic that needs to be put together and the cost relative to that, and how could we, I guess, look at a cost-sharing thing? I know it took Guy a long time to get me away from two soup cans and a string. So
that's clever.
So that's a pretty broad question. The actual connectivity is very straightforward to make happen. It's just, to oversimplify, think of a black box. You're going to plug different wires in, and we can connect them on the inside. That's not the big issue there. The issue is getting, I don't know what physical building is in Templeton that they want to, I'm not familiar
with. Let's say, for example, it was the community service district building where they do whatever they do there.
Right. So let's assume then for a minute that building is somewhere near either the Level 3 fiber or the NASMENO Water Project fiber. We typically have little junction boxes, much like you do with electrical, that we can connect fiber at. As I said a minute ago, it's a little oversimplified, but they just have to get to the nearest junction box where we're at, and we could connect them. We'd have to put the agreements in place, but, that's...
Okay. Supervisor Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson. Guy, I had a couple questions. A number of years ago when the state water line was put through the county, there was fiber optics and or conduit placed with that. Is that true?
I don't know. Sorry.
Because that's what we were told in the Pomo. They were put in secondary line, and they said it was for fiber optics. So I didn't know if we were part of that or it was one of the servers that we were using.
That I'm aware of, no.
Next question, the compatibility with utilities going in the ground, what can and can't you put fiber optics next to? I mean, gas, water, sewer, all that is good?
As I said in that one slide, it's pretty much immune from noise and other things related to other utilities. Okay. So there are some minor limitations, but pretty much anything.
Because along with what Ms. Rogers said about going into Santa Maria, gas company's been putting in a major line and doing construction in the Pomo along Orchard Road and going into Santa Maria. So it would be one to look into possibly.
Yeah, in fact, I guess about 2-3 months ago, there was talk about other connectivity between Napomo and Santa Maria, if you recall, and before that project was halted, I was in conversations with them about how can we connect, because one of the places we'd like to connect to is Santa Barbara County, mm-hmm. right? The county organization itself. So we were hoping maybe we could create that cross-connection there, but
good.
Unfortunately it didn't happen.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Supervisor Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Guy, I wonder, as we're moving towards staff direction, as something that would come back to us if you have a wish list of things we'd like to do, if that could be prioritized, and then maybe we look at three projects, we sketch out proposals, you can consult with the EVC, anyone else that you think would be appropriate, and look at some actual things that can be brought back to the board. Obviously, as I see our CAO shaking his head, there'd have to be some price tags as to what this would cost.
Which way is he shaking it? So.
What are the potential partnership opportunities, et cetera? But, we've heard that from some people today, certainly, being involved as myself and Supervisor Meacham have with the economic development project. This has been identified as and you've identified it too, as a real driver in economic development, and certainly in our community as we see more of the high-tech companies staying here happily and expanding. This will, and certainly with the electronic medical records going forward with all of our hospitals and others, obviously there's a great number of opportunities. So I think, I would love to see you know, look at that wish list, really prioritize it. Here are the top three things. Here's what, you know, here's what they would bring. Here's how we could develop partnerships. Here's what we're looking at in terms of actual expenses, that kind of stuff. And I don't know how long you think that would take to come back to the board. What do you think? And, you know, because I would, you know, I do think that rather than just saying good presentation, thumbs up, because we heard from Mr. Rosales and others we wanted more than thumbs up, I'd, you know, look at an actual proposal.
We got time next week.
Actually, if that was your...
As a broadened definition than public benefit used to be, meaning I know that there are some restrictions on things, but certainly public benefit probably never included hasn't totally included this kind of partnership, but...
Sorry for jumping in there for a second. One of the things that Tim Williams and I have been discussing is we have needs. If you go to the other side of Highway 101, we've got a major facility there, and it's just continuing down Grand. So when I shared this presentation earlier with Tim, he said, well, maybe there's a reason that Digital West needs to go over there as well. So that was prioritized very low in our list, but if a company like Digital West is already going there, we can come back with projects that are specific to something that somebody else already needs or wants to do. So partnering with Grover Beach and or Digital West might be an opportunity in the very short term. So.
Very good. Thank you. Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From your first presentation, I remember that connectivity to the wider world was an issue we talked about, and in all four cardinal points of the compass. Can you speak a little bit about where we are on that? Are we good? We have the cable landings coming trans-Pacific. Mm-hmm. You know, we also have reason to communicate north and south, and also to the east. Have we worked on those issues at all, or do you see that more as a private sector question?
So this kind of goes to the second or third slide I had. The county, my office has been solely focused on the county issues. So. We haven't focused on some of the rural areas where there's citizens quite so much.
And I'm not, and I would, you know, I would love to have a gig coming to my house 4 miles from Highway 1.
Right.
But you know, and you know, if you're on a timeline like next week, that'd be great. But no, I'm thinking more communications with major metropolitan centers. You know, more interregional kinds of things, and whether any consideration's been given to that.
Apart from connecting to the counties on either side of us,
right,
and to the east of us,
yeah,
I haven't been part of very many conversations.
Okay. I mean, it seems to me that that's the logical next step at some point, and also may or may not be a particularly expensive step. But, you know, I think our information well-being, our economic well-being that's tied to the information economy really depends on that wider connection as well. So.
Agreed.
You know, and Mr. Savage, if I may follow up on that line of questioning, we have a number of regional state offices here. Caltrans is an example, State Water Resources Control Board. I suspect they need better connectivity with their other regional offices as well as their state offices. And have you had any conversations with any of the state agencies? We've got the California Men's Colony, the Atascadero State Hospital, and I would think that they would greatly benefit from the ability to, you know, have faster and better connections with their parent agency as well as their sister agencies. Have you had conversations with them at all?
We have in some specific areas. For instance, the CHP. CHP has needs to be able to obtain court data and DA data, so on and so forth, district attorney data. So we have had conversations with them. We have talked to Caltrans, particularly as it relates to the GIS mapping of some of the fiber that's out there. They have separate connectivity to the state already.
Oh, do they?
So they're not as interested necessarily in getting back to Sacramento because they have a path for that.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean that we couldn't be saving money in other ways by leveraging some of what they have to get to a smaller field office maybe that they don't have connectivity to today.
I see.
There are opportunities like that.
Okay. Thank you. Supervisor Meacham?
Yeah, I kind of want to follow up with the EVC's request on this grant in terms of, I guess, you're trying to fill the data gaps, I would assume, about where the infrastructure is and where it's not, if I understand correctly. I always kind of like to have a plan B. If they're not successful with that, does that hinder our ability to move forward with some of your priorities right now?
I don't believe so, no. We, you know, presentations such as this and some of the kind of roadshow that I've been doing talking to various groups, we're beginning to make more and more of those conversations. Again, it's just not economically feasible for us to think we're going to build this on our own.
Right.
That had been our thinking. We know that doesn't work. So I think it'd be great to have a countywide map of all the fiber that's out there, all the different players, and so on and so forth. But and I'd love to support that effort directly and plan to personally if we don't officially. But we can do other things even without that. But that is that's plan A, right? And we can develop a smaller plan B on our own.
And I guess as a follow-up to that, if we were to follow up on our plan, could we work with the EBC to try to put together a database or some type of an infrastructure mapping so that way, if they're not successful with that grant, we still have a lot of information that can be provided to us as well as to them and put something together?
I think that was how I was going to try to refine my direction, which I think in consultation with the EBC, I know Tim is on the board and there's also other tech folks involved, and there's also, of course, just the cluster. That's part of the economic development strategy, and maybe that's something where, you know, our priority list is probably really based on our public agency needs, but this would give us a chance to maybe let the private sector, EVC being a good agency that we're continuing our partnership with, to do that and to you know, maybe that's part of the knowledge and innovation cluster looks at our list and says, well, here's what we think would be the best opportunities that could be a private public partnership, mm-hmm. And that could come back to us as some implementation proposals. I think that's a good idea.
Right. And I think the benefit of the EBC is that we have other jurisdictions represented there as well,
right.
So they could
right.
be part of that conversation. So, Mr. Savage, do you feel comfortable? I agree with Mr. Buckshaw's assessment of where we are and what we're hearing, and I think that, you know, you could maybe carry that forward and come back before the end of the year if we have time on our agendas. We have 9 meetings left this year, and we might be able to squeeze something in if something can happen that soon. Supervisor Teixeira, your light's on.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson. Mr. Savage, one final question for me would be, CHP and some of the state entities already dialed into this program. Would it benefit them to hook up with us with the loop system like you showed in Paso Robles, where they have a backup where their system is going back and forth to Sacramento, and we offer them that option to come on board with us and EVC and the rest of them and work with it to make it a more efficient system in case of an emergency at Diablo, earthquake, flood, whatever we have?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. And
okay. Well, let's see. We did have basically what you were looking for was some direction. This was just an informational item, but hopefully we've given you enough to chew on over the next several weeks, and we look forward to hearing back from you, and thank you for being here this morning and this afternoon.
Thank you for taking the time. Very much appreciated.
Thank you. With that, we'll move on to the next item on our agenda, which is closed session, and I'll ask Ms. Neal for an estimate on how long we'll be in closed session.
Yes, Rita Neal, County Council. It's estimated to be about 35 minutes.
Okay. I'll open it to the public for public comment on closed session. I have no request to speak, so I'll close it. And we will adjourn to closed session and then reconvene right at 1:30 to report out.